So am I still waiting, waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Revolver.
17 million homes that have availability for this show tonight. It will pay $20, hopefully, for the privilege to see you guys do what you have done for 3.5 years. Thank Terry Funk for all he's done for this company, for help putting us on the map, for being unselfish in selfish times, for taking the young guys and showing them a better way. Tonight we have a chance to say, yeah, you're right. We're too extreme. We're too wild. We're too out of control. We're too full of our own shit. Or we have a chance to say, hey, fuck you, you're wrong. Fuck you, we're right. Because you have all made it to the dance. Because believe me, this is the dance. Start the show.
Welcome everyone to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting. How are you doing today, Wei?
Pretty well. Pretty well, man.
Busy.
Busy. Really, really busy for us this past week, or this coming week as well.
Yeah, you've been all over the place this week. You were in London, Ontario, locked inside of a house for 2 days.
Yeah,
you
with
were,
fighters.
You were freed on Tuesday afternoon.
Uh-huh.
And watching a lot of wrestling.
Oh, man.
And then next week, it's UFC 129 week here in Toronto.
Yeah. I think, I don't know about you, John, but I've come to realize that just even one day away, like a Monday night away from the city, or from away from a TV, it costs a lot, you know. For me, like if you miss a Monday, you're missing 3 hours of stuff that you have to catch up on at some other time. So it gets very busy, but you know, I enjoy it. I love it.
How have you enjoyed the transition from just a fan to now people depend on you watching this stuff? Yeah. You are now obligated. I mean, a year ago, you could have easily missed Raw if you didn't feel like it.
Yeah.
Or Impact. Well, now there's an entire world that goes so far as to make signs for you that depend on your opinions on Tuesday and Friday mornings.
Well, it is very much because of you, John. So I guess I have you to blame.
I fully take responsibility for dragging you into this.
Sucking me into this
but
world.
But unfortunately, you've gained a following.
Well, it's our following. I mean, it's because of you.
70-30
well.
You.
Okay. Anyway, I gotta say it's on some weeks it's terrible because even now, especially you know watching these 3 hour Review Away shows, a lot of times like I find that I'm just not in the mood to enjoy it, and at that point I don't think I'm you know we're necessarily doing the right thing if we're not in a mindset to actually enjoy the product. But other weeks I do really enjoy it because doing all this has really made me a much more educated fan. I think I watch wrestling completely differently than even when I started doing these podcasts now. And I've become a bigger fan of wrestling as a result, actually, believe it or not.
I definitely watch differently when I'm know that I have to review this and analyze it. It's very different, and I didn't realize it till we started doing all of these reviews, just how different I look at things and pick up on little things. Because a lot of, like, you know, going back and watching some of these WrestleManias I had watched in the past, and this barely legal event I have previously seen, but watching it this way, it's weird. There's like matches where I have a completely different opinion of in this sense than before. So it's rather interesting when you go back and watch shows you've already seen.
Yeah.
And when you speak about not being in the mood to watch wrestling, this past week, as I mentioned, I was very, very sick on Tuesday this week. And I went home sick, and I had the whole day that I could have watched this barely legal event, and I just did not want to watch any wrestling. And I didn't watch any wrestling that day. I just couldn't bring myself to sit in front of a TV and take notes. And thus, I left this to the night before, but finished it in time.
Well, I know it's been suggested, but I think Not this week, but obviously, but I think eventually at certain times we probably owe it to ourselves if we are, you know, feeling that shitty to take a break, I would say.
Yes. But what's the point when you know you have to come back and finish this at some point?
Yeah.
We got a big show today, Wei. In addition to our Barely Legal review, we're going to be joined by two guests.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be joined by Lance Storm, who was competed on this show against Rob Van Dam. And we're also going to talk to Mike Johnson of PWInsider.com, who attended this show at the ECW Arena. He was a regular at the ECW shows at the ECW Arena. So we're going to hear from Mike. It's always great when we get to chat with him. And he's going to share the live experience of watching this. So two very different perspectives from a performer and a fan at this show.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to those chats.
Me as well.
So let's get into it, Wei. It's Barely Legal, April the 13th of 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you first become familiar with ECW, Wei? Mm. Because for me, it was always like Pro Wrestling Illustrated, because they got a lot of coverage in those magazines.
Sure.
But I never saw them until they got the television deal on TNN. Like just clips here and there, but I didn't have the internet. So
I had heard a lot about it through the law. Of course, you know, and I don't think I actually saw it until it had its debut on TNN. That first pilot, I decided to tune in, and they just showed like highlights of their best matches, and they showed that RVD and Jerry Lynn match.
Yes.
So that was my first exposure to it. I hadn't really been following it at the time, and I just knew it was different.
Yes. And, of course, prior to this, just a few weeks before this event, they had the big invasion show on Raw, where the ECW crew showed up and got to plug their pay-per-view. And it was basically the WWF was just desperate for eye-grabbing attention at that time. They were dying in the ratings to Nitro, and thus, you know, rival promotions were welcome to try and drum up some interest on Raw at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you... What I had was a home video of this from when it was released years after the show. So a lot of this was edited on this video I watched, where a lot of the entrances were edited, the music was changed around,
yeah.
There was nothing of the backstage skits. It was severely edited.
I believe I watched the home video as well. I watched the Pioneer version of this,
yeah,
not the WWE version.
The WWE one did an even bigger job to it.
But I didn't notice too much. Too many changing of the themes. Like the Metallica version of Enter Sandman was still there.
The Metallica version or Motorhead?
Sorry, the Motorhead.
Because it was originally Metallica.
Oh, I see.
They changed
gotcha.
It to Motorhead.
Oh, okay. Well, then, yeah, I watched the same one as you.
I don't know what else was changed. I just was looking online. Apparently, there was a lot of backstage vignettes and stuff like that were all cut out. Because you just have a match. They'd basically go to a graphic and then come back with the next segment.
Oh, okay. Well...
Joey Styles starts off in the ring, and there's a huge ECW chant. He was on the mic, and the audio was horrible here, and wearing an oversized suit jacket. This was a suit designed for, like, a 300-pound man on Joey Styles. This was a gigantic suit.
They had a low budget. Maybe he borrowed someone, Bubba Ray Dudley's suit.
It might have been Abdullah the Butcher's suit,
sure.
Based on how big this looked. The Dudley boys come down along with Sign Guy Dudley and Joel Gertner, and they take over the ring. And we hear a big chant of, "Fuck you, D-Von." And D-Von cuts a promo, says it's time to testify. And they go into the opening highlight video for ECW with the classic theme.
I was wondering why they were chanting that to D-Von and not Bubba, because at least the current the incarnation of the Dudleys as we've known them for the past 10 years, Bubba has always been seen as the leader, at least in my opinion. But chants were directed at D-Von. Was he the more over member of the Dudleys at this point?
I really don't know, to be honest. Maybe it was just. They latched onto D-Von here in this opening segment. And our first matchup of the night was the Dudley Boys defending the ECW tag titles against John Cronus and Perry Saturn, the Eliminators. And Cronus comes down alongside Saturn, and he yells into the camera, "Ass, baby, ass!" What does this mean? Ass, baby.
He loves
ass.
It. He loves ass.
Sign Guy attacks the Eliminators from behind, and this allows them to hit the total elimination right before the Dudleys attack them from behind. Now, the total elimination is basically where one of them delivers like a spinning heel kick to the head of the target, and at the same time, the guy's legs get swept out from under him by a kick.
Yeah.
So, a very devastating move to take, and it looks impressive.
Looks very impressive. Would you say it's that devastating to take?
Yeah, well, it doesn't look like the most comfortable thing to take.
Okay.
These guys didn't look like the smoothest in delivering it. They just potatoed the shit out of their opponent.
But a good move.
We see a bubble bomb to Cronus, then a headbutt by D-Von for a two count. Tilt-A-Whirl slam to Saturn, and then D-Von gets another two. One of the things about ECW matches is that they always had the ring mic'd so heavily that it always just kind of added to the... whenever a bump was taken, there was just this giant crash. I always associate that with an ECW match.
You're absolutely right, actually. I didn't really notice it until you brought it up. But while talking about the acoustics, the arena they were in, the acoustics are fantastic, at least the way they come across on the camera.
Because you would have thought there were like 5,000 people in this arena, and there were closer to like 1,100.
Is that how much it was?
Yeah. That's the same as like the Impact Zone, basically.
Because the way this room is and the way it sounds, they pack all these people into this tiny space, and all of them you could hear. You could hear all the chants really clearly, and the whole time, it just sounds fantastic.
We continue onwards. This match was like, it was almost like they were told, you guys have 25 minutes, and then they came to him, well, you guys have 8. And we're going to get all our stuff into 8 minutes here. Because it was just one spot after another.
Uh-huh.
And mainly to showcase the athleticism of the eliminators here.
In particular, I thought Perry Saturn here really shined. Because a lot of very impressive high spots and you know, the flips and the kicks and all that.
Yeah. We saw a Tilt-A-Whirl slam delivered to Saturn. D-Von gets another two count there. Then we see the Saturn salt off the second rope. But ends with a Uranage by Bubba Ray. Then the Dudleys are stopped, and Cronus hits a spinning heel kick. Then a spinning roundhouse kicks by the Eliminators, a double super kick to Bubba. Then we see a stereo twisting splash to the Dudleys from both Saturn and Cronus. And as they clear the ring, the Eliminators are there in the middle, and they hug. They hug to celebrate clearing the Dudleys from the ring. Then Saturn springs off Cronus for a moonsault to the floor. Cronus hits the space flying Cronus drop, which is basically a handspring elbow into a moonsault over the top, very reminiscent of the Sasuke special that we reviewed last week.
Or the space flying tiger drop, as I believe some people call it.
No, well, there you go. You're much more in tune with the Japanese terms than I am.
I could be bullshitting. We'll have to call WH.
Yes.
Make sure.
There's a springboard heel kick by Saturn to D-Von. Then Cronus hits the Snooki handspring elbow into the corner. Saturn hits a top rope elbow to Bubba Ray. Then a springboard Saturn salt, which is basically a quebrada to Bubba from one top rope to the other. And then Cronus hits a 450 to D-Von. Crowd is very hot for these spots. And they finish off with the total elimination to Bubba. The Eliminators get the pin on Bubba, and they are your new tag team champions. This was the crowd was really into these high spots, but
yeah.
Boy, was there a lot of them.
The high spots were fantastic, but everything in between those high spots was nothing. I really got no sense of struggle at all. It just seemed like the Dudleys and all the guys here were just walking into position from one spot to another.
Yeah, it kind of lacked that flow where it was exactly like my criticism sometimes of some of the ladder matches is where it's just one stunt to the next and it doesn't really
with no
flow.
Match in between. It was like, how am I going to get from one position into another? And often it was just simply as going over and then, I don't know, a cheap punch and laying down.
Then Joel Gertner's in the ring and he cuts a promo saying that according to the Dudley scoring system, the Dudleys won the match by a score of 86-83, which clearly he was doing a Cecil Peoples gimmick here, because based on the spots in this match, it was all of the Eliminators,
pretty much. The last 7 minutes of this match was all the Dudleys laying around. They didn't even get a comeback before the finish.
This was like Joe Warren getting a 30-27 at Bellator last weekend.
Yes.
The Eliminators attack. They deliver the total elimination in their pink and white tights to Joel Gertner, and they celebrate their tag title win. So we got 3 total eliminations here in this one match.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the move is over. You know, this is the first show on pay-per-view. Perhaps they wanted to just introduce this huge move. What did you think of this choice as the first match on the show?
I thought this was fine.
Yeah.
Got everyone into it. I mean, the Eliminators are really over. I mean, this crowd, I mean, they loved these guys.
Yeah.
Like, this roster, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I mean, that they had developed one of the most loyal fan bases ever here in Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
Where they treated everybody like they were just these gods. Yeah. Then afterwards, we cut to Joey Styles, who says that Chris Candido was set to face Lance Storm, but he has a partially torn biceps. And Chris Candido's then in the ring with a sling on, and he then cuts a promo about two women running him over with a motorcycle.
Huh?
Like Mickey James.
Oh, because she had a sling on.
Yeah. Okay. Candido says he was on the very first ECW show in 1993, and that a year ago, he was with Tom Pritchard and his girl, winning the tag titles at WrestleMania, and now he's back, and it's ECW, he doesn't have a t-shirt, and they have forgot about him. And he makes challenges to the Sandman to come hit him with a stick, he cuts a promo on Stevie Richards, on Terry Funk, and says he should be in the main event.
Okay.
All right.
He was supposed to be in this match against Lance Storm.
So instead, it's going to be Rob Van Dam and Lance Storm, and this is Lance Storm complete with his rat tail.
Oh, my God.
At this point in 1997, a dyed blonde rat tail.
He bleached his rat tail. Oh, my God.
Everyone had fashion faux pas at certain points in their life.
I know our audiences love the Dragon Ball Z references, but I'm sorry, I can't help myself. Lance Storm's rat tail, very much like his source of power, like the Son Goku's tail.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. That's what I wrote down here. RVD gets Chance of You Sold Out because he was doing the gimmick at this point where he was trying to jump ship to WWF or WCW for more money. They start off with the fish out of water spot. Then we see a high cross off the second rope by RVD, a tope con hilo by Van Dam to the floor, and then a leg drop off the top and a lazy cover by Van Dam. Storm then makes his comeback, leaping to the top rope and hitting a reverse elbow. Storm then misses a pescado over the top to the floor, and Styles makes a crack about there being no pretty blue mats here in ECW. Mm-hmm. We don't use mats. We let guys fall on the pavement.
Well,
like men.
It's extreme.
Van Dam then hits a moonsault off the guardrail to the floor. A chair is brought in by Van Dam. He tosses the chair into Storm after an Irish whip, and then a drop kick into the chair into Storm's face in the corner. That did not look pleasant to be taking, especially from Rob Van Dam. Van Dam then misses a somersault splash in the corner, and he gets slammed front first onto the chair. Storm hits a reverse heel kick, a cartwheel splash into the corner, and then a springboard clothesline off the top for a two count. We see a rolling Boston Crab into the single leg by Storm, a slingshot guillotine leg drop to the floor by RVD. And then Van Dam attempts the Van Daminator. Storm catches the chair as it's thrown to him, and he responds by delivering a light chair shot to the head. And you would have thought he just, like, urinated on the Philadelphia Flyers hockey jersey here. This audience was disgusted at the lack of a stiff chair shot to the head. Unbelievable. And we'll bring this up to Lance because he obviously, I think, was well ahead of the curve in 1997. And this crowd, by 2011 standards, it was a bit of a mystifying. But you know what? There's tons of fans who probably boo this in 2011.
Perhaps. I don't see the point in doing him at all, but I guess those are... when you're working with RVD, you have to work those in.
Storm gets crotched on the top rope, and then Van Dam goes for a springboard heel kick off of the top rope, but he slips, and he recovers and can at least hit a back elbow, but gets chants of "you fucked up" from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And man, it was always a staple chant for the ECW crowd, but just watching this, it's like, what assholes?
Yeah, but come on. They have very, very high standards.
I'd be so pissed if I just fucked up and was probably in pain from fucking up. And here these assholes are chanting, "you fucked up."
Yeah, okay. I see your point. But I find it very endearing, you know. They created this chant.
Endearing.
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's it's, you know, as a fan, you want to show that you are educated enough to know when something goes wrong, and you want to make fun of somebody for it. But come on,
in 20 years, there's going to be two 27-year-olds that are going to be reviewing WWE from 2010, and when the chants of "You Can't Wrestle" come out, they're going to be, that was really endearing at the time. The way they spotted how shitty Great Khali really was as a worker.
Absolutely.
It was endearing.
It's funny. It's a memorable thing. It's great.
There's another chair shot by Storm, and then a Van Damminator for a big pop. It was almost like Van Dam turned himself babyface here because of Storm's lack of force with these chair shots. It was like the crowd wanted to see him.
Perhaps, but I think that's also because of Rob Van Dam's style. It's just impossible to want to boo this guy when he does such spectacular moves. And RVD doesn't really make it easy for you to boo him either.
Van Dam, he hits the Van Damminator, and then a standing moonsault, and Van Dam gets the win here. After the match, Storm tries to initiate the Code of Honor, and RVD basically thanks him. He's like, "Thank you for having a great match with me on the pay-per-view." And says he doesn't care about the locker room or Paul E. He says he sold out by putting his boots on tonight, but he's worth more now after winning.
I was actually really impressed with RVD here. I didn't know he could talk like this. I thought he was talking better here than
ever.
Yeah, I actually mean it. Like, he way better than he's ever been in WWE or TNA. So it was like he was completely different. I know he's playing a heel here, but he just showed just the real confidence and smoothness in his voice.
Up next, we have a six-man international tag bout. Some characters from last week making their return here. We have the great Sasuke teaming with Gran Hamada and Masato Yakushiji, who is replacing Gran Nanawa on their side, taking on Taka Michinoku, Dick Togo, and Terry Boy, who would just a year later become Kaientai in the WWE.
Yes. Well, in Michinoku Pro at this time, they were already Kaientai DX, but for whatever reason, I guess just to get them familiar with the ECW audience, they decided to put them into the BWO.
Yes, their own heel group, or I guess comedy troupe or whatever. But
now, was this before or after Calgary Stampede?
This was just before it. It was
just before it. Okay.
Stampede would have been July of that year. This was April.
So then I suppose the word of mouth from this match eventually got to the Fed, and that's why they got the chances that they did?
I think so. I think they had seen Taka's work in ECW and brought him in, and they were basically talked into, because they brought in Great Sasuke for that Canadian or Calgary Stampede match.
Against Taka, right?
With Taka.
Yeah. Masato Yakushiji, the moment that he is announced, he elicits a Power Ranger chant. This audience looks at this guy, and what he's wearing is this...
the Tommy outfit.
It looks exactly like the Green Ranger's outfit. It was like huge, bright green shirt and pants with like lightning bolts across it. And I guarantee you, he has no idea what these people were chanting. The Yakushiji.
There was so much in this match here. They mentioned that Sasuke had just competed at the Tokyo Dome the night before, taking on Jushin Liger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Wei, as someone that has traveled to that area of the world before, flying basically overnight. I mean, wow. Japan is, what, 13 hours ahead?
Uh-huh.
That's crazy to have flown from a show.
It's about a 14-hour flight.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Sure, he's used to it. But yeah, just this was, I guess, the North American introduction to Michinoku Pro, who, I mean, at the time was delivering some of the, to this day, some of the best multi-man tag matches that I've ever seen.
They really set the blueprint in the early and mid-90s, and that was one thing. It was always a knock on ECW that they were just a blood and guts promotion, but they had some fantastic in-ring workers and bringing in international talent, whether it be from Mexico or Japan, that it's not really fair to paintbrush ECW as simply a company that was full of 40 Sandmans. That was just really not the case at all. That was certainly a portion of the draw, but that wasn't it at all. I mean, this is a company that introduced Juventud Guerrera, Rey Mysterio, Psicosis, tons of talent, super crazy. Tajiri, you can go on.
Like you said, it's not fair to paint the company just as that one hardcore, with that hardcore paintbrush. And it's not fair to paint that audience with that same stigma either, because this was an audience that, yes, they, they would do things like boo weak chair shots, but they also really appreciated good work rate. And you could see from this match the reaction that they got.
Michinoku, Togo, and Terry Boy, they all played like the heels in this match as members of the BWO. They did they would get Sasuke into a hold and then like stand on him and pose.
That was like that is
awesome.
Still one of my favorite spots. They would do this all the time in Michinoku Pro whenever they would have these multi-man tag matches, and it would even be more impressive when they would do the stacking pose with
yes.
all five guys.
Anyone who can like look at Taka here and be like, oh, this guy had no personality in WWF to get over. It's like he showed so much personality in this match without saying a word.
I absolutely love this heel group so much. And when it's unfortunate that they kept the name Kai and Tai into the WWE, because the Kai and Tai DX that existed in Michinoku Pro is like one of the best heel stables in my mind ever. The way that these guys wrestled, everybody had their own personality, their own character in the ring. You had Dick Togo here, the power guy, and then you had Kaz Hayashi Taka Michinoku, the high flyers, and then you had Men's Tao. Mm-hmm. Men's Tao here, Terry Boy, who's a huge Terry Funk
yeah,
fan.
Yeah, and thus the name. Yes. Terry Boy here, he continues, he does this one spot where he throws Yakashigi to the floor, and he keeps just rolling back in, and then he'd throw him out again, and then eventually Terry Boy went for a baseball slide and hit a tilt-a-whirl head scissors to Terry Boy onto the floor. Back in the ring, they had a Taka in the ring with Sasuke going back and forth, and as we mentioned last week, of course, Taka was like the one of the Sasuke's proteges mm-hmm. at the time, and so this had to have been cool for him getting to work with Sasuke here on a North American platform. Yakashigi, he would kick out of a brainbuster kicks out of a brainbuster by Taka. No real reaction for the near falls here. It seemed that they were just into the fast-paced nature, but not really into some of the near falls early on. They attempted a double hip toss here into a powerbomb by Terry Boy to Sasuke, but they messed it up, and again they had to they basically went to the same move again with Sasuke, then turning the powerbomb by Terry Boy into a Hurricane Rana for a two. This crowd did not have the heart to yell at Sasuke or any of them.
No, a lot of the people in this audience were already familiar with the great Sasuke, probably from tape trading and also from the Jacob specifically.
Yes, absolutely.
And so he already came in here with a huge advantage with the crowd behind him.
Sasuke eventually hit an Asahi moonsault to the floor onto Togo, mm-hmm. Right by the guardrail.
He went over the guardrail.
He cleared it. You're right.
Yeah.
There was a beautiful tornado DDT by Hamada to Terry Boy for a two count. Then Hamada hit a top rope Hurricane Rana to Dick Togo. Yakashigi then hit a Hurricane Rana off the top, and then a Tope Suicida. I thought he really shined a lot in this match.
Who is this?
Yakashigi.
Oh, I completely agree.
He looked great in this match. And yep. I don't know what the turnaround was of when Gran Nanawa got replaced in this match, if it was short notice or what, but he looked great in this match. And then we saw a springboard dropkick by Taka to the back of Sasuke's head. This was right out of Otani's offensive maneuvers. And then Yakashigi breaks up the fall after a Michinoku driver. There's a quebrada by Sasuke for a near fall. And then a powerbomb delivered to Taka, and he wins with the Tiger Driver. The Tiger Suplex for the victory here. So Sasuke pins Taka. Really, really solid match.
Yeah, definitely the standout match of this show. The pacing was really unlike anything seen in North America at the time. Just whenever these guys would run the ropes, the pace, the energy was just so great. And it just, like, captivating, very captivating. And I really enjoyed how they seemed to pair each guy mm-hmm. on each side here. You had Dick Togo here, whose foil on the other side was the other power guy in Gran Hamada. And you had Taka with Great Sasuke, because obviously with that protege connection. And then I guess Yakashigi and Men's Tao, because they were the only two remaining guys. But even things about this match that I really enjoyed, things like the commentary, I thought Styles did awesome here, just following every move perfectly, and he did a good job. But as well, the camera work was, I thought, good too, worth mentioning, because something I enjoyed about this show was that they'd stay on the wide hard camera like 80% of the time,
mm-hmm.
and it really gives you a better sense of height and distance when you can see a wide angle, which is very effective for this style when the guys would move everywhere and jump everywhere.
Yeah, a fantastic match. And an interesting note here, Gran Hamada, I mean, hung with all these guys clearly. He was 45 at the time of this match.
Mm-hmm.
It was nuts. This guy's doing top rope Hurricane Ranas with ease. Incredible from all six guys. I thought this was a great, great match to add on to the pay-per-view. Then Shane Douglas is out with Francine, and Douglas was the television champion at the time, and there was a lot of smoke in the arena at this point, and I don't know what it was from, because they really had no pyro, so I don't know what it was from.
Maybe it was a smoke machine.
Maybe. Maybe it was Rob Van Dam's celebration. And he gets on the mic, he says he was going to take ECW to Nirvana, and they have arrived on pay-per-view, and says that he was the first one to call out pussies from other organizations and they did not respond. And he brags about breaking the neck of Gary Wolf, and they showed a clip here of when Gary Wolf, who had legitimately injured his neck, and then they did this angle later on once he was able to make his comeback where he had a halo on, and Douglas grabbed him by the halo and started shaking.
Yeah.
The halo.
Now, was this halo real? Was it really?
It was a legit halo, but his neck had recovered by the time they did this angle.
Okay, so it wasn't, it was fake. It was a work. It wasn't drilled into his skull.
No. It was a work halo.
I don't know. I can't tell. I don't know what lengths certain people will go to. But it had me cringing.
Well, so that was basically the impetus for this match, where Gary Wolf, him and the Pitbulls, Gary Wolf and Anthony Durante, they were managed by Francine, who then turned on them to join Shane Douglas. Douglas broke the neck of Wolf, and now Pitbull number 2 was going for revenge against Shane Douglas for the television title. So that was the setup for the match, Way, and we had a guy at ringside with a motorcycle helmet on because they said that the Riot Squad has been brought in to protect Shane Douglas because he's so hated. And going into this, there was also this storyline about a masked man who they were hinting was Rick Rude. And they were basically telling you, it's going to be Rick Rude, but what will he look like? So it was a way of kind of delivering on a promise, but still trying to swerve people. So
what was the reason for the mask?
I guess it was just to add some question as to whether it was Rick Rude or not.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get into that at the
You know, finish. Maybe, yeah, this, especially with this storyline, it seemed a little complicated, and as their first show on pay-per-view, I think I would have preferred, you know, like to have seen some
video. It could have been
video
a little more...
Or at least have Styles, I don't know.
Well, they summed up the fact, the broken neck was the main focal point. It's like the guy's going for revenge of his partner's broken neck. Mm-hmm. And they showed Gary Wolf at ringside wearing a neck brace here. Mm-hmm. And so we start the match off, and this was where I kind of scratched my head. So, you know, Way, I consider you a very good friend. Mm-hmm. And if somebody broke your neck and I was fighting for revenge, I wouldn't be going and exchanging holds with the man who broke your neck right away.
Yes.
He went for a hammer lock here. Now, he then transitioned into a front guillotine, and Styles basically said that, well, he's trying to break the neck of Shane Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
So that made more sense to me.
I thought it was effective.
Right at the beginning, it was just wrestling holds. And to me, for a personal issue, you're not going to be going for holds.
Well, you have to work your way into that front guillotine.
Okay.
You got to wrestle him down, but... thank you, John. I appreciate what you say. So,
I would immediately go for a tilt-a-whirl head scissors, sending a guy into a hard wall.
Well, that's very sweet.
Yeah, if you were at ringside with a neck brace on or a halo.
So Pitbull 2 applies a headlock, and the crowd starts chanting, "Break his neck."
Break his neck. What a bloodthirsty audience.
Break his neck. Break his neck.
Douglas then counters a powerbomb into a Hurricanrana, which, after what we've just seen in the last match, I don't know if he wanted to be borrowing moves from the Michinoku Pro Six Man, but they tried. Mm. There was a succession of pile drivers delivered to Pitbull number 2. We got a chant of "She's Got Herpes" at Francine, who was in Douglas's corner.
Yeah, and what shocked me, kind of, was that here's Shane Douglas doing, what, like three pile drivers? pile drivers.
Yeah.
Pile drivers, and they get no reaction. And instead, fans are chanting she's got herpes at Francine.
It's a camel clutch spot by Douglas. Douglas is then tossed through the timekeeper's table, which was a wooden table at ringside. And then Gary Wolf jumps the guardrail, and the riot squad subdues Gary Wolf and takes him backstage. He had seen enough. He just had to jump the guardrail and go for Douglas. Pitbull then tosses the guardrail right into the ring, leads to chants of "We want blood." Douglas ends up dropping the guardrail onto the back of Gary, not of Wolf, onto Durante on the floor from the ring. Pitbull makes a really bad comeback. He had really, really weak punches.
He looked really tired.
Yeah, this guy should not have been booked to go. How long? This went like almost 20 minutes. I think it did go 20. Weak punches. Douglas regains the heat. Douglas then comes off the top with a drop kick by. He comes off the top rope and he's met by a drop kick by Pitbull number two. Then Francine passes brass knuckles into Douglas. Then comes back with a chair. There's continual near falls here.
And a piece of wood.
Yeah, he hits him. He hits Pitbull number two with a piece of wood from the broken table, two count. Hits him with a chair, two count. Crowd could not care about these near falls at all. They weren't into this at all. Then he continued to beat him with the broken table parts. Another kick out. Zero drama here. Then there's two belt shots to the head of Pitbull. And then Shane Douglas, out of ideas, goes to take the chain out of his boot, which he's had this whole match. And Pitbull ends up hitting a shitty pump handle to stop Douglas. And then he grabs the chain and hits Shane Douglas. But then Candido gets on the apron. He takes a chain shot. Francine distracts Pitbull number two. Shane gets a roll up for a two count. And then out of nowhere, Douglas just clean hits him with a belly-to-belly overhead suplex and pins him. This match sucked.
Yeah, I was in.
This went way too long, and Pitbull number two could not be hidden in this match. This exposed him extremely.
It was yes,
large.
I completely agree with you. I mean, I thought the storyline going into it with
this
the
match was all
was
story.
Good. Yeah, and I thought it even started off well with the two of them going for the broken neck, going for the holds on each other, but. At the end, it just really fell apart. I think largely due to the booking of it. It was just, come on,
you go through. And what a payoff here! The heel wins clean.
You go through seven weapons and then various run-ins and then a belly-to-belly suplex wins.
This was way too long, just way too long.
And it wasn't over.
No, because then, over the loudspeaker, the words "It's howdy doody time, Shane." reverberated through the ECW arena as the masked man comes out with a wrestling robe that reads "Simply Ravishing" on the back. And the gimmick here is that he wants Francine because he loves the women. He gets into the ring with the mask and the robe, and he makes out with Francine right in front of Shane Douglas. Douglas attacks him, and then the motorcycle helmet guy comes in, takes his helmet off, and the man with the riot squad is Rick Rude. So who's the masked man? It's Bulldozer Brian Lee. And for whatever reason, this got the greatest pop ever. This crowd went nuts for this.
Yeah, they did.
It was like, not only we got Rick Rude, but we got a surprise. The masked man, we got a bonus. It was like ECW. It was like, okay, they basically promised you Rick Rude as a surprise, and they still gave you another surprise. And the crowd just was apeshit for
what
this.
What was his name? Brian?
Bulldozer Brian Lee, the Underfaker.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Who'd later become Chains in DOA.
All right. Well, that's quite the bonus.
That was your pop at the end, everyone.
Okay, but yeah, say what you will about the rest of this match. The crowd loved it. I mean, how can we really criticize?
The post-match. Were they really into the match?
I thought they... I don't know. I guess maybe that was just the base level of enthusiasm for an ECW crowd.
I guess my interest was really low, so...
I wasn't really interested in this match.
This dragged, I thought. Then they announced the grudge match of the century is next with Taz, accompanied by Bill Alfonso, taking on Sabu. This match had been like a year in the making. This has been a huge, huge program in ECW, and finally these two unbeatable forces were going to meet at ECW's first pay-per-view. And Taz comes out accompanied by Alfonso and Team Taz. And early on, Sabu blocks the Taz mission, and Styles really plays it up that no one has ever blocked the Taz mission. For those that only saw Taz in like WWE or TNA, you have no clue just how well they protected this guy and made him seem like a killer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people legitimately believe that Taz in a shoot would destroy anybody in wrestling. Like, they did just an unbelievable job with Taz.
Absolutely, and he had the style to back it up. A very technical, methodical style, lots of devastating submissions, and perfectly executed suplexes that he could do to anybody.
Early on, Sabu was bloodied up in the face. He hits a springboard crossbody off of a chair to the floor onto Taz, who is in the crowd, clears the guardrail. Taz comes back and clotheslines Sabu over the guardrail. Sabu then threw a chair at the face of Taz into the corner and then a drop kick off of the chair. And then we see a super stiff clothesline by Taz the fans pop for. I just thought it looked really good. It looked like he took this guy's head off. There's a triple jump springboard, and Sabu hits the guardrail upon landing. Taz then suplexes him into the audience. A table is set up between the ring and the guardrail. Sabu stops after a triple jump attempt, and Taz blocks a swinging DDT by Sabu and puts Sabu through the table, which is ledged between the two. Sabu is then back into the ring, works to a top rope hurricanrana, then a top rope guillotine leg drop, and then Sabu is suplexed right onto his neck. Sabu applies the Taz mission, and Taz reverses it with a suplex, and they tell the story that only Taz knows how to reverse the Taz mission, and then Taz hits another suplex, applies the Taz mission, and gets the win here right in the middle of the ring.
Yeah, I thought this was a decent match. I mean, I at times I found it a little awkward due to the clash of styles. Mm-hmm. You have Taz, the technician, versus Sabu, who was really, really reckless, I thought, and like wild and kind of sloppy. He screwed up like a table spot here. To me, like, Sabu really comes across as like a parkour guy, but he doesn't get much practice. Just sets things up and hopes for the best.
So glad he didn't have a girlfriend on Twitter when this was going on.
Oh.
Like the other parkour guy.
Yeah.
Taz gets on the mic after the match. He says, "I choked you out. That's what happened." And then he says Sabu gave him the fight of his life. Some fan yelled something at him, and he basically told him to fuck off. He says he has respect for Sabu. They shake hands. Each raises the other's arm, and they hug as the fans boo this show of disgusting sportsmanship.
Cheesy.
RVD then runs in. He attacks Taz from behind. Taz goes for RVD, and it ends up with Sabu and RVD double teaming Taz, as the fans cannot believe this. Like, wait a minute, you fucked with us.
Yeah.
Alfonso gets in the ring. He takes off his Team Taz jersey, revealing a Taz shirt. Then he takes that shirt off, and then he's got a Sabu shirt underneath. And everyone clues in here immediately when they see the Sabu shirt. They're like, oh no, he's turned. He's bought rival merchandise. And he raises the arms of Sabu and RVD, and Alfonso has joined Sabu and RVD. Alfonso gets on the mic. He says that Taz cost him a lot of money tonight. He says that he owns Taz and he owns his colors. Now, the only logic hole here is that Alfonso had this shirt on at the start of the match, meaning he had pledged his allegiance to Sabu. Yet he put all this money on Taz to win this match.
I think he said he put money on Sabu.
Oh, because that would make more sense, because Sabu did lose.
Yeah, he said he put money on Sabu, and so Taz won.
So why would he leave Taz for Sabu when Taz beat him clean? Wouldn't you want to stay with the moneymaker? You're right. I got that all backwards.
He goes with the loser. That didn't make sense. And I guess back then it wasn't as cliched as it is now with the whole stupid T-shirt thing.
But this was a big deal at the time, this turn here. Where,
sure. A year in the making.
Alfonso left him for Sabu, and that's where he would be most recognized. But anyway, we continue on. Joey Styles is... He then welcomes Tommy Dreamer as the guest commentator for the next match, and Dreamer comes out with Beulah McGillicuddy, and he gets a pretty strong reaction here from the Philadelphia crowd.
Mm-hmm. Was he injured here?
I don't know what was going on with Dreamer at the time. He very well could have been injured. But
because
Dreamer, it's like he would have worked hurt.
Because they said that he had given his spot to Terry Funk.
Yes, that was the storyline. So the Blue World Order then storms the ring, accompanied by Stevie Richards. who's going to be part of the upcoming three-way match here with the Sandman and Terry Funk, and then the winner would get a title shot against Raven immediately following the match. And this is where Sandman comes out to enter Sandman. On our version, it was the Motorhead edition, but in the arena, it was Metallica. Does his usual entrance, is bleeding from the forehead. This thing was like a pay-per-view in and of itself, his entrance.
Yeah, I mean, since this pay-per-view's aired, we've heard all about the problems that could have happened had they gone over just that, what is it, 30 minutes before the, what did they say, like 10 minutes?
I don't know what the legitimate thing is. Like, I was reading the other night that had they gone 10 seconds longer on this pay-per-view, the whole building was going to go out of power and they would have lost their feed. I think that's somewhat... It sounds sensationalized to the top degree. We'll ask Mike Johnson about that. He might have a good read on that.
Yes.
We'll find out. But that was one of the key scenes in Beyond the Mat, was Heyman telling them, you guys have to get to them and let them know they have to go home in X amount of minutes.
Yeah, and then there are people telling Heyman, there aren't even X amount of minutes. They have to go home now. They have to finish it now. And here Sandman takes up 5 minutes of those very, you know, important, precious minutes with this.
We got an awesome piece of feedback by someone who, his teacher was actually working with Heyman here and the associate assistant producer on this show. So
Sandman here smoking cigarettes, and remember our discussion about wrestlers smoking cigarettes.
So there was no chance of that's illegal from the ECW crowd.
No.
Very good point. Funk then, Terry Funk looked in very good shape here.
Yes.
For 52 years old here at the time.
Yeah,
I mean, my goodness, he's now 66. Incredible. Early on, Funk delivers 4 Hangman's neck breakers to Stevie Richards. Sandman brings a ladder into the ring. He throws it over the top rope, and it hits Terry Funk upon landing. Terry Funk, fuck, did this guy take a lot of damage from Sandman throwing shit into the ring in this match.
That's his gimmick.
Sandman was wearing these Sean Kemp Reebok basketball shoes. And I know that because I owned the same shoes when I was in grade 7. This guy, I never enjoyed the Sandman. I always thought he was just so awkward to watch, so ungraceful, and I was never at a live show where I got to experience his entrance, where I think a lot of people loved this guy, but I never got into this guy at all. He was such a turnoff for me.
Sure, and I think a lot of people would agree with you that the Sandman really... maybe 60-70% of his appeal is that entrance and the fact that he has this character.
People will always say that Paul Heyman, he could find the littlest things in guys and turn them into stars, and they name all these examples. I'm sorry, nothing more than the Sandman needs to be shown as an example. Like, this is a guy who, like, I don't know how Heyman made this guy into a star, but he did.
He fit the role.
Because I never could see anything in this guy.
Right. I mean, yeah. He not a workhorse by any means, but he fit the role that he was given very well.
He was over, to a huge degree. Funk climbs up the ladder, which is in the corner, and hits a moonsault off of the ladder to Richards. Pretty much completely misses him, but this was Terry Funk, and there was no way this guy was going to get booed or you fucked up. Incredible that this guy was busting out a moonsault at the age of 52.
Off of a ladder.
Richards ends up getting suplexed onto the ladder. Sandman and Richards then climb the ladder and fight, and Funk knocks the ladder over. Funk then has the ladder on his shoulders. This is an infamous visual where he just starts spinning the ladder around, knocking both guys over in the head. And Dreamer is just fascinated here watching this guy perform. And Stevie then hits a Stevie kick to Sandman for a 2 count. He hits a Stevie kick to Terry Funk for a 2 count. Sandman then, with the most ungraceful dive ever, goes over the top rope to knock the ladder up because it's in like a teeter-totter spot against the guardrail, and it just flips up and hits Stevie Richards.
No, Stevie, I think, completely missed the ladder.
Did it miss him?
And so the ladder just
flew into the
over.
Air. I didn't know if it
flew
hit him or not.
Into the crowd.
Then Sandman grabs a trash can, but it had like a second like sheet metal around it, so it looked extremely heavy here. He tosses it over the top rope, and it lands on Terry Funk's head. Christ, did this look painful. Sandman then comes off the top, hits the ladder, and it springboards over the top, and ends up... Okay, let me re-explain this. The ladder was in the ring, over the leaning over the top rope. Sandman climbed up to the top, jumped to the outside of the ring, hitting the top of the ladder. Mm-hmm. It missed everyone in the ring, so it flipped over to the floor and landed on the Sandman's head.
That's what I was. That's the one I was.
Okay, about. We had two different teeter-totter spots. Right. This was like, what an idiot.
Yeah.
This guy flicked the ladder and it landed on himself.
It was really, really stupid. But the audience...
I didn't know how this didn't generate laughter.
The audience loved it for whatever reason. I think, you know, the ECW crowd is very much like it's a mosh, like a mosh pit at a concert. Mm-hmm. The stupider and the more violent, the better.
Then Sandman somehow is back into the ring. Him and Terry Funk deliver a double powerbomb to Richards, and that's how Stevie Richards is eliminated. So we're down to Sandman and Terry Funk. Sandman uncovers barbed wire, which was hidden beneath the streamers that they must have thrown in at the beginning of the match, because we didn't get to see that. And Funk then pulls the shirt off of Sandman over his head, starts punching him, whips him with the barbed wire, and then puts a garbage can over the head of Sandman. Stevie comes back in and hits a Stevie kick to the garbage can on Sandman's head, and then Funk hits a moonsault and hits the Sandman with the moonsault, and Funk pins the Sandman to advance. And immediately Raven runs out, and we get our ECW title match.
This three-man was featured some really awful wrestling, but that's...
This crowd more than made up for it. They were behind Terry Funk here.
Yeah, they told a fantastic story with Funk. He's very easy to get behind, but, you know, I guess the style of wrestling really is not about finesse.
No, this was not. And this whole setup I really liked, because Raven's character was always this character who he just like leached off of people. He took advantage of situations, and here Terry Funk has just killed himself, and now Raven runs in fresh to defend this title. I thought it really worked well for the babyface heel dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Fans were just so behind Terry Funk here. Funk is selling like he's just out, and we see a drop toe hold to Funk right into the chair, and he just does a gigantic blade here, and he's gushing blood. Dreamer then informs Joey, I can't do commentary any longer. I just have to watch. And believe me, Tommy Dreamer was not exactly contributing at all here on commentary.
No.
He was extremely stiff here whenever he spoke.
Was. And I was.
But he did add a real touch to it.
Absolutely. Yeah, his quietness. Initially, I just thought, wow, he's not doing anything. He's not adding anything to this team. But in the end, his quietness really helped get across how concerned he was for Terry Funk.
We continue onwards, and after that, Funk, they tease a doctor stoppage as a doctor comes in, and Funk, you can just see the blood gushing out of this wound on his head. He's completely covered in blood. Raven drops a table onto Funk. He hits a plancha over the top to put Funk through a table. Then the doctor is attacked by Raven, and then this female, Reggie Bennett, runs into the ring, attacks Funk with a chair and a sit-out powerbomb, and they state that Reggie Bennett is the newest member of Raven's Nest.
It's a woman?
That was a woman.
What? Really? I thought it was a guy.
That was a woman.
I thought it just looked like an overweight man.
No, it was a woman. Raven is on the mic and says that he's going to end Funk's comeback and his career right in front of Tommy Dreamer. And Dreamer then stands up, taking just disgust at these words. Way is now checking if Reggie Bennett is a man or a woman. And you give us the results, Way.
She does look like a woman.
All right. Then as Dreamer is standing up, Big Dick Dudley comes out. And Styles and Dreamer are situated on a balcony away from the ring. Big Dick Dudley comes out, and Styles just yells, Big Dick Dudley is back! He's out of jail! Always a line I love. To me, that summarized professional wrestling to fans that never watch. This hick who's out of jail, and he's back. And Raven attacks referee John Finnegan and hits a DDT. They tease Dudley, Big Dick Dudley, choke-slamming Tommy Dreamer off the balcony through a set of three tables that are stacked on one another. But Dreamer blocks, and it's him who choke-slams, and I use that term very, very liberally, Basically, he put his arm on Dudley's neck, and Dudley pushed him off, and he just took a back bump, slipping off the balcony, going through these tables. He went through, like, one of them and then took a giant fall to the floor where there were no pretty blue mats to cushion his fall. Hell of a fucking bump here.
Yeah, yeah.
Completely unnecessary.
Fell off a balcony. Come on.
This was totally unnecessary for this match, but this crowd loved it. They went nuts for this bump.
It was unnecessary, but in the end, I don't think anybody regrets. I don't think he probably certainly doesn't regret doing it. For this show, the first ECW show, I think he wanted to end off with something like that.
Dreamer then is in the ring, and this was significant because he had promised going into this event that he would not involve himself in this match. Terry Funk had promised him not to interfere. Dreamer got into the ring. He DDTs Raven, and Funk gets on top. They go to count, and it's so close that the bell ringer rings the bell, thinking it was a three count. I'm positive that was deliberate to just try and do something
really
different. Yeah, I totally think
I thought
it was
a little confusing. May have worked against
I thought it didn't work, but yeah. I think they probably thought in their head maybe this will really pop them, that
okay.
Even the timekeeper thought it was the finish. And I think if there was more breathing space, because
yes.
They immediately went to the finish where Funk hit a small package, and then you got the win just seconds after that bell rung. So I think the crowd was a little confused. And they celebrate with Dreamer in the audience with Terry Funk. Funk is all bloody, and the show goes off the air with loud chants of Terry by the ECW arena in Philadelphia. And thus, ECW's first pay-per-view, which went off with a very, very positive, emotional moment of Terry Funk winning the ECW title from Raven. And overall, I thought a pretty good show. When I had first seen this pay-per-view, I thought it was just phenomenal. I wouldn't call it phenomenal, but it definitely had its high points.
I think we have to be mindful that we're not watching this in the context that it was originally
on
presented.
That day in that arena, you probably left thinking it was one of the best shows you had ever seen,
because I don't even remember how much what wrestling really was like at the time, but I could probably safely say that a lot of this style of wrestling was very unfamiliar to casual fans of WWE or WCW. So not a great wrestling show, especially watching in 2011, aside from the Michinoku Pro match, of course. But what made the show to me was that it established itself as a true alternative to the others.
If I had never heard of ECW, maybe I just saw that Raw where they plugged in. I was like, you know what? WWF's not so hot right now. Maybe I'll give this a chance. Mm-hmm. And ordered it for whatever it was, $20, $25. I was totally going to order the next show after this. They left such a strong impression that I'm always such a big advocate. When you have a hot crowd like that, it's really contagious.
Absolutely.
If you're the television viewer that, like, if this crowd's so into it, I want to be there.
Yes.
I want to watch it. This feels like a hot product that I want to catch.
Totally, completely agree with you. And I would go ahead and say that most of what made this show work was that audience, was that crowd. Take the crowd away and really, I don't think this show would have been impressive at all. Just a lot of, I don't know, weird, awkward wrestling. But the crowd definitely made it for me.
I'm going to give this one an 8 out of 10.
I give it a 6 out of 10.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm just talking about my viewing experience for this. I didn't think it was a great show to watch.
I thought
watch.
There was a good beginning, the six-man, and I thought it ended really strong. I thought the Terry Funk story was really well done.
Yeah, it was.
And I enjoyed the Michinoku Pro stuff a lot. Douglas and Pitbull dragged it down for me.
It's just not my cup of tea, I guess.
Yeah. So those are our thoughts on Barely Legal, and now we're going to go to a guy who performed at Barely Legal, Lance Storm, and we're chatting with him about Barely Legal, as well as his reality show, World of Hurt, which debuts away this coming Sunday on The Cave.
As well as his rat tail.
Yes. It's a pleasure to welcome back one of our favorite guests, a man who is busy as always, Lance Storm, joining us to chat about a number of different topics. And Lance, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic.
Coming up, we want to start off discussing World of Hurt because it's going to be premiering this Sunday, 5 Eastern, 3 Mountain Time on The Cave here in Canada. And I guess, have you had a chance at this point, Lance, to go back and watch any of the episodes now that it's been a few months since you guys wrapped up production?
Yeah, I've managed to see 4 of the 10 episodes so far. So I've got one more to watch later today. They've sent me the first half, which is pretty cool to sit down and actually watch finally.
And I know we discussed this a couple of months back on the law, but the concept of this is that you're not starting students from scratch. These are all established talents that you had already worked with previously here, so it's more of a kind of fine-tuning style of course, correct?
Yeah, although I hadn't worked with all of them before. Some of them were former students of mine, but not all of them. But yeah, people that have had some level of experience already, taking it more as a fine-tuning course rather than teaching them from the beginning how to bump and how to run ropes.
And now I know a lot of people are probably going to compare this a lot to Tough Enough, and I'm curious if we're going to see any segments where you stick any attack dogs on your students.
No, there's no attack dogs. There's no cheerleading course.
Oh.
And there won't be any dance-offs, so it won't be reminiscent of NXT either.
Have you gotten to see most of the episodes of Tough Enough thus far? I know it's not airing up here in Canada. You have to kind of go the alternate route for Tough Enough.
I made the effort to watch the first episode, and as soon as they got to the house in the first episode and started the token sexist argument, I just had to turn it off. I don't like all the fake drama in the house stuff that you see in reality shows. I did forward to the last part and watch Steve Austin's promo on the final three, which was certainly far more entertaining than the crap in the house.
Yeah, that seems to be the strength of the show that everyone's kind of echoing, is that Steve Austin, this has just been a, I wouldn't say a revival for him, but definitely something for the wrestling audience that I think that this was, he was the perfect guy, I think, for this role. Someone that even the diehard wrestling fan has a lot of credibility with and is a perfect person, I think, to put in that role.
Yeah, big surprise, Steve Austin is the star of the show.
Well, we knew it wasn't going to be, who was the first girl? Arian Andrews with her Melina Ashley Fox, Alicia Fox, which I think is going to be the line of the entire series thus far, unless someone can top that.
That'll be a tough one to top.
Now, one of the students that we are going to see on World of Hurt, Tennille, she's actually been signed to a developmental contract. So has she started in Florida yet?
Oh, God, no. She hasn't even gone for her medicals yet.
Oh, really?
Although the girl that the first episode features on, Irina, she's been signed as well. Two of the people off the show have been signed already. Irina's already gone and done her medicals and drug testing and passed that, so she's just sitting back waiting for visa.
What's kind of the wait time for Canadian talents that are signed? I mean, is this like a several-month process of just kind of waiting for all this paperwork? And I know visas can be extremely taxing to get all that stuff processed.
Well, neither of these girls are Canadian, but the two guys of mine that were signed are Canadian. And I think it was probably about a three-month process from when they were first sent the contract till they went, took their medicals, passed those, got the visa done, and then were shipped out. So it's probably about a three, maybe even a four-month process from your first offer till you report to work.
Well, that makes a pretty good segue on our part, because we also wanted to have you on. This week we were reviewing the 1997 Barely Legal event, and this would have been kind of not your first ECW appearance, but at this time, tell us a bit about working here in ECW, because you've discussed it in the past about kind of coming down to ECW and kind of being on Paul E to kind of get your visa work in order so that you weren't stopped at the border. I mean, was this at a time where your visa issues were not exactly figured out working with ECW?
Yeah, this was well before any visa stuff was taken care of. I think this was only my third or fourth appearance for the company. I was only coming in one show a month in between my Japanese gigs. So it wasn't a big concern of mine at that point because I wasn't there often. But the Barely Legal show, I had just done the 24-hour trip from Japan to Calgary, had, you know, only half a day in Calgary, and then had to fly to Philly for Barely Legal. And due to some huge airplane, airline snafus, it took me almost 20 hours to get from Calgary to Philadelphia. So I was running on practically 3 days no sleep when I worked that event.
Mm. Wow. Now, Lance, have you had a chance to see the show recently? And if so, do you have any thoughts on it from today's perspective?
I haven't watched the entire show recently, although it wasn't that long ago I watched bits and pieces of it. Atmosphere was just so amazing. That dump crappy little arena, the ECW arena, was so horrible when you first see it, but so amazing to work in. All the people were just so close. And the people were so rabid that the volume and stuff, it was often a louder, more energetic room than, you know, buildings with 20 and 30,000 people. Mm-hmm. In some ways, Sky Dome was the biggest building I ever worked. WrestleMania 18, where there was, you know, just shy of 70,000 people there. And in ways, there was more energy in the ECW arena with what would have been probably 1,200 people. Just because in the Sky Dome being so big, the sound sometimes gets lost in the roof and you don't get it back. Where in the arena, you had some amazing, just the sound just sort of stayed in there, so it got louder and louder. So that pay-per-view was just amazing from an energy level. And I remember it would have been after the cameras went off, but all the boys came back and got in the ring, and the crowd was just unbelievably loud in a really loud thank you chant, which was just really amazing just to be standing there in the crowd just saying, thank you, we really like this.
Mm-hmm. Now, the acoustics of the show definitely came across even in the broadcast. And I was just curious, do you know much about the, I guess, the technical production side of things, how they would mic that audience and mic the ring and mic the room to get that sound to carry across on TV?
I have no idea how they did, but I think because it was so small that as long as you had a microphone in that room somehow, you'd get that volume across. Because it was just, you know, you're in a small little chamber. There was no place for the sound to go but everywhere. So you didn't have to worry about the sound getting lost, where, you know, you watch some pay-per-views today and you realize that you can see the crowd going crazy, but you don't hear them when you go, oh, they've mic'd it poorly. But in the arena, it was just so small that you couldn't help but catch the atmosphere.
For as a performer, Lance, I mean, was it almost a bit jarring going from Japan into this arena with such a rabid crowd and a very knowledgeable crowd by 1997 standards? I mean, just your initial foray into ECW, I mean, what did you make of the audience? And I mean, was that difficult for some performers to get over where, you know, a blowing spot, these fans were going to be on you for that kind of thing?
They would be, but... I was very fortunate. I went a long time before I ever had that happen. It was actually a little badge of pride of mine that I hadn't had the "you effed up" chant for a long period of time. I still remember the first one I got in a match, and it was actually Rob Van Dam slipped off the rope trying to do a kick.
Yeah.
So it wasn't directed at me, but it was the first time I'd had one in one of my matches. And I'd been there quite a while, and I was really hoping to go as long as I could without having one in my match.
What did you think of that particular chant in itself? Was it something that the guys, that was something that it was almost keeping them on their toes to keep their stuff tight? Or was it something that, you know, the performers almost took very negatively that this audience would be on them to that degree? What was kind of the locker room reaction?
Not too many people I noticed it bothered too much, but I did get annoyed that a lot of the ECW fans in other arenas, they weren't marks for us as much as they were marks for the ECW arena fans.
Uh-huh.
And they would always want to do their chants. And if you did a spot where you missed a splash or something, they would chant, "you effed up." And I found that annoying because that was being a dumb mark.
Yeah.
Rather than realizing that you've blown something. Although one thing that was interesting, I worked Sabu once, and I worked him more than once, but this one occasion, he really liked working the fans. And he hated the chants because the fans thought they were smart. So he worked in a spot where we purposefully looked like we were doing, I was doing a move, he was doing a different one, and we'd crash in midair and collide, hoping to get the crowd to chant, "you effed up." Because then he could lay there and laugh going, "we worked them."
There, you outsmart the smarts. That's the key. Now, I imagine you were present here for the infamous pre-show speech that Paul Heyman gave that we got a glimpse of watching Beyond the Mat. What was that like for you? Was that the first time you got the big Paul Heyman pep talk?
I got a smaller one. Paul is the eternal babyface and knows how to hype everybody. So the first time I worked in the arena and came back through the curtain, he was, you know, blowing smoke up parts of my anatomy as soon as I got through the door. But, yeah, that was the first full-blown locker room, us against the world speech, which was amazing. Even if you didn't believe it, you couldn't help get tied up in the emotion that he delivered. And I've said for years that other sports teams or wrestling companies or non-wrestling companies should hire this man as a motivational speaker just to hype you up for a fight, a basketball game, a football game, what have you, that he really knows how to motivate people and make them think that what they do is important and you have to give your all. And I think that was the heart of ECW.
Yeah, and on that point, I mean, so many people, they'll talk about when TNA will bring up references to the WWE and almost putting WWE on this pedestal, and they'll go back to ECW bringing up WWE and WCW, and I find that a completely illogical argument, because ECW always presented themselves as, yeah, we don't have the money of one of the big companies, but you put our guys against their guys, we have the superior product, the superior fan base, and it almost, you put the audience in this kind of underdog phenomenon, and it just created this unbelievable culture at the time, which is completely a 180 from the culture that I think TNA has breeded.
Yeah, Paul managed to convince everybody, the fans in the arena included, that if you had worked in WWE, that was a bad thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not the highlight of your resume, and really did the screw them, we don't need them. We don't need the people that have been there. We're the best, damn it, and screw the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that worked for our fan base and for the boys in the company, that we were the, you know, the little engine that could but didn't have a track to run on, so we're going to forge our own path.
Mm. Now, Lance, I know you were a little new to the company at the time, but had you heard about any difficulties about getting the show actually onto various pay-per-view carriers prior to the show actually happening?
Not really, because I was really only in maybe 3 or 4 days. I do remember Jericho, who had just left for WCW when I had debuted in TNA, or TNA, Jesus, ECW, that he was saying that I might have timed it right, that he had heard that they were close to getting a pay-per-view deal and maybe I could get on the first one. And he thought that would be really cool. So I knew they were trying. And then when it came along, I was just really hoping that I'd been there long enough that I'd managed to squeak onto the card, and then I got lucky and did, so.
How did you feel after that first match with Rob? Because if I'm not mistaken, you were originally to work Candido on the show, weren't you?
Yeah, it was probably 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon before the show when I first found out I wasn't working, Chris.
Oh, really?
Joey Styles came up to me and said, "Do you have a finish yet with Rob?" I just looked at him and said, "I'm not even working Rob. What are you talking about?" And he's like, "Candido tore his bicep. You're working Rob Van Dam."
Oh, wow.
I'm like, "Oh, okay." And I don't think I'd even met Rob at that point. So I had to track Rob down, who was probably partaking in recreational activities at the time, and see what he wanted to do.
And how was taking your first Van Daminator at the time? Because that looked like a pretty
That wasn't so bad. But the standing moonsault afterwards, I didn't know about.
Oh.
The finish was Van Daminator. So I took the Van Daminator, and I'm just laying there unconscious with my eyes closed. And all of a sudden, this really stiff, crushing blow to my chest knocks the wind completely out of me. And I'm laying there trying to figure out how this guy covered me so stiff. And it wasn't until I watched the match back on VHS back then, that I realized that he did the standing moonsault to knock the wind out of me, because I didn't know he was doing it.
Wow, that's an interesting little fact that we got out of Lance here. Tell us as well about your reaction at the time. Of course, a lot of people look back to the chair shots in the match. I mean, what was your initial reaction that this almost turned you heel in the match? It was a bit, maybe not surprising given the audience.
Yeah, I was, again, very new to ECW. And I was still a firm believer in the you worked stuff, and wasn't too comfortable hitting people in the head with steel objects. Turns out I was a decade ahead of my time.
Yeah, really.
But in hindsight, it worked out great, because it did lead to the finish. So doing the lame chair shots into him, kicking the one into my head really stiff, ended producing a better reaction for the finish. Not that that was my plan by any stretch of the imagination, but in hindsight, it ended up working okay.
Yeah, I thought so too. I mean, by the time they hit the Van Damminator, it was just giant pop from the audience, and I didn't assume that you guys had kind of planned that to work out that way, but absolutely, it worked out, I thought, really well for the crowd, and we always talk about hindsight, but in that case, I think foresight on your part was 2020, because one of the hardest things for me going back and watching old tapes is seeing some of these just brutal, brutal chair shots with guys who probably at that time had no idea what the long-term consequences could have been, and I think it's something that, you know, I wish more guys kind of had that mindset at that time period.
Yeah, the late 90s, watching stuff back, it's frightening at times.
Was it, was there any struggle to sort of fight against those spots, you know, feeling uncomfortable with it at the time in the back when you're planning your matches?
Well, not really, because I just put my hands up. I didn't give a shit. And the first time I worked with Balls and Axel, and Balls completely murdered me with a chair shot to the head. I walked back into the locker room and went to Paul and said, if he hits me in the head with a chair like that again, I quit. I had my Japanese gigs, and I wasn't willing to get knocked unconscious in wrestling matches. So Paul proceeded to book the rest of the feud, with the end of the match being I hit Balls with a chair shot. And before I'd go out, he'd always counter with, if you come back and that chair's not bent, you're fired.
Wow.
And since Balls was eager to get hit as hard as he could, because Balls wanted to get over as a hardcore guy, he'd be telling you, please hit me as hard as you can. Paul wanted me to hit him as hard as I could. I didn't hit him as hard as I could, but I certainly topped the Rob Van Dam chair shots.
Wow, a very, very interesting mindset for some guys to be certain. I'm also curious, Lance, when you got to see Beyond the Mat and just kind of the behind the scenes look at that particular event, anything that maybe stuck out at you watching that documentary and getting to see kind of how they chronicled that entire initial pay per view?
I enjoyed it. I think at the time, to me though, the Mick Foley chair shots and stuff from Beyond the Mat, as well as the referee from Texas on the trampoline, were always the things that I remembered most from the documentary. I suppose because I had seen all the ECW stuff before, it was just rehashing in the film for me. But the other stuff was far more entertaining for me.
I'm also curious because one of the stories that has come out of that first Barely Legal pay-per-view, which I don't know is kind of grown in legend, was that they were basically fighting the clock before like a power shortage was going to occur in the ECW arena and they would have been knocked off of pay-per-view. Was there anything that you recall of that story about basically they had to get off the air pretty much when they did?
No, because I didn't spend the rest of the show in the locker room. When I had come back through the curtain for my match, I'd walked by a guy that was just spraying hot stuff on himself, and I inhaled it.
Oh.
And I had a bad reaction to it, and my throat started swelling shut a little bit. So I spent the whole rest of the show sitting out by the ambulance with an oxygen mask on, watching the show on a little 3-inch monitor that the EMT guys had. So I wasn't actually in the building for the rest of the show. So any running around backstage or plans as far as, you know, hoping to get the show off on time, I would have missed because I was having difficulty breathing sitting out by the ambulance.
Hmm. Wow. Very fascinating. Now, Lance, my final question for you is, at what point did you make the decision to get rid of the rat tail, and will we ever, ever have a chance to see it again?
I have almost no hair left at all. I shaved my whole head down to stubble now, so we won't be seeing the ponytail back. I don't remember when I decided to get rid of it. Bleaching it was getting really dead and like a chunk of straw, and my barber once took more of it off than I wanted to, so I wasn't really happy with it anymore. So I remember going to Paul saying, you know, if you want to cut this off on an angle, I'm planning on getting rid of it anyway. And he said, no, not really, go ahead. So I cut it off.
Oh, that one of the rare occurrences of, I think, Paul Heyman dropping the ball there, because that would have been, I think, fantastic, getting that shaved off in the ECW arena.
Yeah, but he had other things on his plate, so.
Well, Lance, I really appreciate going back and kind of recollecting some of these thoughts of what is a pay-per-view that stands out for a lot of people, especially the regulars there at the ECW Arena at the time. And before we end off, I definitely want to give you a chance to plug World of Hurt, which is coming up this weekend, and also the Storm Wrestling Academy and when the next session is coming up.
Yeah, you can go to stormwrestling.com for information on Storm Wrestling Academy. My next session starts the, 2nd of May, and then another the beginning of September. There's still a couple spots open if you wanted to sneak into either one. And yeah, World of Hurt, May 1st, 5 p.m. Eastern on The Cave. I believe it will air repeatedly throughout the week, but the 5 p.m. Sunday is the premiere slot for the episodes.
Fantastic. And I also, just to finish off, want to congratulate you. You've been clean for 1 year right now. I believe it was April of last year that you swore off Impact, and I don't believe you've fallen off the wagon in that year.
I did end up catching one episode. I was in Seattle for Brian Alvarez's wedding.
Uh-huh.
And I was at his house, and they had to watch it for their show. So I did watch it once at his place last year. But that would have been the only time in the last almost year and a half I've seen Impact.
Well, I can't say that you're missing out on much. I think those 2 hours, very, very valuable to add to your week. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Lance. Really appreciate the time, and all the best with World of Hurt, and we'll definitely chat with you soon in the future.
All right, thanks, guys.
So that was Lance Storm, everyone. For more information, you can go to stormwrestling.com. And, of course, World of Hurt, it is debuting this coming Sunday on The Cave in Canada. So now we're going to transition over to your feedback. First of all, I want to thank everyone. Both Way and I, we were very hesitant last week doing the Super J Cup review. I didn't know how many of you guys would be into it, but we got a ton of feedback on this show, and it was like all positive. So I'm glad you guys all enjoyed it. We are going to plan to do another J Cup review in about a month's time, maybe around mid-late May, and we'll bring back WH for that show because it seems a little, I thought he added a ton to the show, mm-hmm. and we are going to do another one of those. But let's get into our feedback, Way.
You want me to start?
Sure, you can start.
Karsten. Great show as always, guys. I had never heard the story about Hassan and Guerrero. Interesting stuff. WH was great, too. I always thought he was a cool guy, even though I've only met him once or twice. And the first time was at O'Grady's a week after I turned 19. Come to think of it, WH spent the entire night just busting my balls over everything, much to his mouth's amusement. So wait, actually, fuck that guy.
But he does have a face with the tongue coming out. What does that sign mean?
It means he's joking.
Well, I mean, what's
teasing.
It called? Teasing?
The tongue out smiley?
Yeah, what does that mean?
It means he's joking. It means he's not serious. He's not really saying fuck WH.
Okay. Aram Nasrallah celebrated a birthday this past week. Huh. Can't spend a better day on my birthday than to listen to Review Away. Thanks, guys, for really being a lifesaver on Mondays. Just wanted to say thanks for the podcast since I've not been able to catch up with the wrestling. Two questions. What do you guys think that could stop the rise of mixed martial arts? Too many lay and pray matches? Maybe the monopoly of UFC? And, Wei, why aren't you going to put in your own... When are you going to put out your own reality TV show? Or you could become the next TV sitcom star. You should have taken over Charlie Sheen's spot on 2.5 Men. Thanks again for the time to entertain us.
Good question, Ram. I don't know why.
Yeah, why haven't you?
Weighing. Just wait. What?
Instead of winning, be weighing. Weighing the options.
Oh, God.
How about MMA, Wei? Are there any things in the not-so-distant future or long-term that could... curtail this. To me, it's the exact same as wrestling.
Yes.
That if you don't create stars mm-hmm. that the public wants to see on a large basis, that's where people will get turned off.
Mm-hmm.
I think bad judges' decisions over the long haul, if enough people just get disenchanted where they're so attached to a fight and they feel the wrong person is so obviously screwed, mm-hmm. that it is going to turn people off, much like it did boxing in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yes. My views on it are, like yourself, very much like wrestling. I think the way the wrestling industry has been for the past 20, 30 years is that it's seen waves of success, and I think it'll only be... the UFC will eventually cool down. What will lead to that cool down? I think, like you said, you know, you have to build stars, and perhaps one day if you see too many title changes way too often, not enough people can get that traction to get that spotlight, and maybe that'll eventually hurt it.
Earl Bryan, hey guys, oh sorry, that's yours.
Oh, Earl Bryan, hey guys, Just some quick feedback for the J Cup. This show is one of the greatest shows I've ever seen. The match between Liger and Sasuke is an easy 5-star classic, and so is the final. Liger and Sasuke also had an awesome match at Battle Formation 96 at the Tokyo Dome, another match worth checking out. The original Super J Cup created wrestling legends in Liger, Sasuke, and Chris Benoit, the greatest wrestler I ever saw. Okay, keep up the great work, guys. Between your shows and WrestlingObserver.com, I have over 20 hours of audio to listen to every week. It makes my traveling much easier.
Jason Perez. Hey, John and Wei. I just recently discovered your podcast and have been listening for a little over a month now, and I really enjoy them. I just finished listening to the Review Away J-Cup 94 show, and just wanted to let you guys know that Gato did appear in WCW at Halloween Havoc 97 against Chris Jericho, and it was a good match. I recall Mike Tenay saying that Gato and Jericho had worked together in the past in Japan. Just wanted to share that with you guys. Keep up the great work. So, Gato, yes, Gato. Jason, you were correct. Gato did work that Halloween Havoc show.
Mm-hmm. Howard Paul Stolber. Hi, guys. I love the review of the J-Cup. Living in the UK, I've never had much chance to see Japanese wrestling, although I remember back in the 90s catching the Juniors of New Japan in action on Eurosport. I will have to try and track down some Region 2 DVDs of these events so I can renew my interest in the sport I used to love.
Wow, we've renewed people's interests. Whoa. In entire genres of wrestling. Hmm. Steve Kassan, really enjoyed the review away with WH Park and hope you guys review more Japan-themed shows and bring Park along. In fact, how about reviewing the first WCW New Japan Super Show with Sting versus Muda and Flair versus Tatsumi Fujinami? I'd really like to have your guys' input on the event, seeing how WH is knowledgeable, his thoughts as well. I have this event on disc, so if you need a link up, I can send you guys the review.
Hmm.
To review.
Yeah, definitely one worth discussing in the future. Stephen Smith, I'd like to add my name to the list of people who enjoyed W.H. Park's involvement. Really good, and I actually hope he returns for more Review Away shows in the future. On a side note, guys, you don't have to read out my super long comment about Tough Enough if you don't want. It all boils down to one sentence anyway. I agree with John and Way.
That's a great thesis.
Okay. I don't know what he was talking about.
He sent in feedback earlier this week. It was a long one. We were constrained by time. Sam Kennerly, my thoughts on Barely Legal 97. Overall, a great showcase of ECW on their first outing. Personal highlights were Storm versus RVD, the six-man Michinoku Pro tag match, and the Eliminators versus Dudleys. I love the total elimination finish, even if it looks brutal to take. The story of the night is obviously Terry Funk overcoming the odds to become champion. It might be nice to watch that ECW scene from beyond the mat to get a better perspective of the backstage feelings going into this show. Glad you guys chose another ECW show. Keep up the good work.
Mm-hmm. You can, of course, find that scene from Beyond the Mat.
Yeah, Beyond the Mat is a great companion for Barely Legal.
Absolutely. Chris Maffei, hey, John and Wei, here's an interesting note about Barely Legal. I'm a broadcasting major in college, and my television production professor was actually the assistant director for Barely Legal. He told me all about that night, and mentioned that Paul Heyman had no concept of time, and as a result, he'd always tell Heyman that the time was 15 minutes ahead of what it actually was. As we all know, a power transformer blew very shortly after the pay-per-view ended, and would have resulted in a lost feed had the pay-per-view gone on any longer. Kudos to Professor Bernstein.
Well, there you go. Professor Bernstein keeping Heyman on check here, time-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Mark O'Brien, it was while watching Beyond the Mat that I got my first glimpse of Barely Legal and ECW as a whole. While not a huge fan of their product, I always liked how much they cared about the product they were involved in, which was probably epitomized best in the infamous pre-show speech from Heyman, which we get to listen to every week at the beginning of The Law.
That's right, and Jason Agnew, the producer of that opening
theme. Yes, he put that all together.
Yeah. Great choice. Scott McCullough, for me, I got to see Barely Legal during my tape trading days. ECW was such a different product to me, with most of the performers not being cookie-cutter images, and the production style being so different as well. This event was the second one I saw after the night the line was crossed, with the Sabu Funk Douglas three-way, and cemented my fandom in ECW forever. Now don't get me wrong, I won't mark out anymore when they bring back the nostalgia like TNA did this past year, but I still break out the old ECW tapes and DVDs to remember my heyday of ECW. On another note, please feel free to bring back WH anytime for a Japanese event review. He was awesome.
WH Park gaining quite the legion of fans.
Oh, he did an awesome job.
Reginald Smithlington Thomas. I listen to an awful lot of podcasts as I walk a lot, and yours has quickly become my favorite. I have to say, though, my favorite show of the week is almost always Review and Impact. Listening to you rip apart the terrible inconsistency that abounds on that show and your exasperation every week is truly laugh-out-loud funny. My only minor quibble is with the consistent pretending on Review Away that you aren't recording long before you put it up is getting old. That being said, you guys are truly great to listen to as a longtime wrestling fan. Man, people really don't like our comedy.
I don't try to be funny.
It's hard to be funny so late on a Sunday night.
Yeah. Eric Creamer, enough of Ms. Cena. Enough of Super Saiyan Orton, Punk. Enough of the bickering commentary team. Enough of Edge retiring. WWE has so much and does so little. It's like TNA, only WWE should fucking know better. I don't care if they aren't going to book the hot feuds for the internet wrestling community, but I can guarantee Vince doesn't watch these same old things week in and week out, and has his world set on fire every time. Can we locate a specific point in time when Vince completely lost touch with what makes good television?
Matt Sterling.
Well, can we? Let's answer the question.
Well,
when did Vince go insane?
You know, I found that it was, I think when you saw, David Laganis talked about this, when he had that double quad tear, that's when Vince kind of distanced himself from meeting with the creative team so often, and it was a lot more Stephanie running things, and Vince somewhat became detached at that point.
Hmm.
And I think there was a bit of a change there. And coming off of the Attitude Era, I mean, for the last 10 years, I mean, there's been a lot of big money-making potential for certain storylines that have been really dropped or not maximized. You can look at things like The Invasion or Goldberg, even Ric Flair's retirement tour. I mean, everyone remembers that great moment at WrestleMania with him and Michaels, but the 6 months leading up to that, it was horrible. Hmm. Not horrible, but like they were just missing it on so many levels that it was just, thankfully you had two great performers in Flair and Michaels that I feel they saved that on the go-home show going into that WrestleMania. And it was just, you watch now and it's just almost like are they going to really maximize this, or are they going to drop the ball? I mean, how many legitimate stars have they created in the last 5 years?
I don't know. I don't know if Vince has always been this wishy-washy about making decisions and leaving scripts until the very hours before the show. I guess from what I've heard, it's always been like this, hasn't it?
I don't think it's always been like that, but for quite some time now, it's just, I don't know how you can function in that environment where stuff has changed. I mean, the story with The Rock and Cena not being finalized till like that afternoon when they were to go to air on Raw the night after Mania, mm-hmm. That's insane.
Yeah, it is.
That's absolutely crazy. And if you don't have that long-term goal of where you're heading to, it's like booking week to week is like you're going to run into walls.
Yeah. I think it's almost a miracle when you consider how quickly these shows are written that they do go off the way they do.
Yeah. Matt Sterling, I went round to the back of the Odyssey Arena before the Belfast, Ireland house show by the WWE on the 14th. The only person to come outside of the arena was R-Truth to smoke a cigarette. Living the gimmick.
Yes, he is. Thulani, Mabuza, and Cube. All these anti-smoking PSA vignettes from the early 90s that people have been posting in response to the R-Truth smoking segment remind me that there was once a time when wrestlers were actually role models. Right now, Cena and Rey Mysterio are the only good guys left, yet the fact that kids look up to them is the same reason they are hated by older fans.
All right.
Well, I mean, I think that goes back to the late 90s when bad guys, or the good guys, I mean, didn't have that squeaky clean image that the good guys do now.
I don't know. I've never been one to, if I had a child, I don't know. It's like, it's just so weird to me that it's like, look up to these people as your heroes. Whether it's an athlete or a wrestler, I think that's ridiculous.
But you did that on your own. It's not like you're telling children to do it. We just gravitate to superheroes and larger-than-life characters.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that.
So you would not let your children watch wrestling?
I wouldn't let them watch TNA. I'd worry about them if they did. So
you would. What would you, if you had a kid and they were seeing this R-Truth angle, how would you explain it to your child?
I do, I for the life of me, do not understand the outrage over this heel smoking a cigarette.
It's stupid. That's what. Why? That's why what the are we outrage even
talking
from?
About it? Like, what's the issue?
Because it's so
it's
dumb.
It's a heel.
Yes, I know, but a heel based on smoking, like. Okay, can you, well, how, a heel, what if I created a character and he is a villain because he doesn't exercise regularly and he eats junk food? How intimidating, how serious can you take a stupid gimmick like that?
I don't know. From the earliest years I can recall, I always, when I would hear stuff about people saying that, you know, music is too violent for teenagers to be listening to for certain bands and shit, or video games or whatever it is, I always thought if anyone performed some act and used that as their excuse, that is such a weak crutch. Like, I just don't understand the connection between the two. How watching something is an excuse for someone...
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that the R-Truth angle is offensive. I'm just saying it's offensive.
If people are talking about how it's a bad... representation for children.
Well, that is silly.
For any child, for a 15-year-old to be caught smoking a cigarette saying, I saw R-Truth smoking?
Yeah.
Bullshit.
Oh, yeah, that is very silly.
I have no sympathy for people who try and use anything from pop culture as a crutch for their own actions.
I am only offended because of how stupid it is.
We're giving it way too much time.
Okay.
William Stewart Young. I had a dream last night. I won a contest on Review Away to meet John Pollock and Wei Ting, which was really cool. However, I ended up staying at an attic-sized apartment belonging to Wei and discovered that neither of them were as big wrestling fans as I thought. And also jerks. A disenchanting dream, to say the least. Well, it's a good thing we never ran that contest, because then your doubts would be removed. We are assholes, everybody.
Merrick Downing. To close us off. Dear John and Wei, I would like to ease your doubts on the future of sports entertainment. As Vince recently announced, I have been a wrestling fan for the last 12 years after a short hiatus since my childhood, and I have to say, I agree. When I mention wrestling to my non-fan peeps, they automatically envisage lycra-clad, muscle-bound giants from the 80s putting on a fake fight. It is so infuriating to trying to explain the complex nature of the business to these people. I'm sick of it. The stigma wrestling has to the general public is not a positive one, and real fans are ridiculed for following such a farce. I believe sports entertainment is the future. We know it's wrestling, but in 5 years from now, when I mention sports entertainment, it will have a much more appreciated vision.
100% disagree.
I don't agree either.
First of all, if your friends are already that turned off by wrestling, asking them what they think of sports entertainment and turning it on, they're going to have the exact same reaction.
I would just laugh at you even harder if I wasn't a fan.
Pro wrestling did not have this negative of a connotation 25 years ago when you had all these different territories. It was viewed very differently at the time.
Hmm.
What people view wrestling as today is what WWE presents. That is what the casual observer believes is pro wrestling, is WWE. And whatever WWE wants to call itself, that's what they're going to associate itself with.
Hmm.
So I don't see, unless you're projecting something different on your television, whatever you call it, the same critics are going to criticize.
Yes.
So I think it makes zero difference what they call it. I don't really even care. It's not a big thorn in my side at all, what it's called.
Yeah, it's funny. That's all.
So that is all of our feedback. We, of course, appreciate all of your comments, which you can always post, Wei, at Live Audio Wrestling's Review Away Facebook group, or simply just go to reviewaway.com. That's reviewaway.com. And you'll notice in the info tab, Wei, I have updated all of the links. I made sure, are all working now, so you can listen to any past editions of Review Away. And I don't know if there's a limit to how many characters we can put in that info tab. It seems like it's limitless.
Seems like it.
So we're going to add the links to a Review a Raw and Review an Impact as well. So if anyone wants to go back, you can check those out as well.
It really would be ideal if there was something on our website that automatically did all this for you. But
yeah, it'd be wonderful.
It would be, but unfortunately we don't have that. So John Pollock is taking time out of his own schedule to painstakingly copy and paste every single link into
this.
Well,
you know what? I got halfway through, and then you know what? You had already updated the other half.
True.
So, Wei, you did a lot too. So those are up right now. We're going to get the Raw and Impact links up as well. So you just have one go-to place and you can just download whatever shows you want. But right now we're going to go to our second interview of the show, everybody. One of the major news sites out there, of course, is PWInsider.com. And one of the men behind that great website is Mike Johnson, who attended Barely Legal in April of 1997. And Wei Ting, you were super busy. So I had a chance to chat with Mr. Johnson about that event and being there in the live crowd at a very interesting time in wrestling history. Well, it's our pleasure right now to welcome one of the foremost authorities there out on the web right now from PWInsider.com, good friend here of the programs, Mike Johnson, joining us to chat a bit about a little show called Barely Legal, all the way back from April of 1997. And first of all, Mike, it's great to chat with you, and thanks a lot for joining us here tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. I mean, anytime I get a chance to talk about ECW, I always get a little excited because it was a big part of my life and why I ended up writing. And, you know, it's something that really was groundbreaking in a lot of ways. We talk about social media being such a big part of the of our life today, and ECW was kind of like the first thing to really grab onto social media within the wrestling industry and kind of ride it for all it was worth, for whatever that version of it was in the early and mid 90s.
So what was your introduction, Mike, initially to the promotion? I mean, were you attending in the early Eastern Championship Wrestling days? What really hooked you into the monthly arena shows?
I was getting the tapes. And what really hooked me was they did an angle where Sabu wrestled Terry Funk on a show, and the angle was that Terry Funk was going to wrestle Mr. Hughes in the main event, which, as we all know, does not sound like much of a marquee main event today, much less in 1994. And over the course of the show, they did an angle where Sabu ended up replacing Hughes, and so they did an impromptu Terry Funk Sabu match. And at the time, Sabu had the handlers that would bring him out on the gurney, and he, you know, was masked and all this crazy wackiness. And Sabu beat Funk after one of the masked men interfered. The masked man was unveiled to be beautiful Bobby Eaton of Midnight Express. They started working over Sabu, and out of nowhere, from the front door, comes Arn Anderson, who was feuding with Bobby in WCW at the time. And he saves Terry Funk and runs Arn and Sabu off, and they have a tag match the next month. And as soon as I realized that Arn Anderson was going to wrestle Sabu and Terry Funk and Beautiful Bobby were in the same match, I was on my way to Philadelphia for the first time to see the show. And by the end of that night, I was just completely hooked because it was so different from anything that was being presented by WWF or WCW at the time. It was like walking back in time to like one of those gritty, smoke-filled, old-school fight club type arenas that you hear about from the days of yore. And it really was this dirty, disgusting, grungy place, and just the music and the Rocky Horror Picture Show aspect, the interaction with the fans and the intimacy and the blood and the violence and the serious tone of the company and the promos, just all these elements just made something really special that I think even if you look back now and you kind of pop it up on YouTube or you track down some tapes and you see some of the WWE edited versions of things, you get an idea of why it was special, but you're not able to kind of grasp completely. It's something that was really perfect for the time period, and if all the same elements were in the same place today, I don't know that it would work as well. They really caught lightning in a bottle and did something special.
And it also, Mike, came at such a unique point, not just in society at the time, but in wrestling as well, where maybe some fans had been disenfranchised at the national level, and here you were watching a product that was just so diametrically opposed to what the national audience was being treated to, and the atmosphere that was created at these shows. I mean, this was the first promotion where, I mean, the audience was as much a part of these shows as the performers in the ring, and I think that was one of the things that anyone who got a hold of some of these tapes, it was something that just jumped out of the screen at you that this is such a hot product, and it just really transferred well to those that if you sampled it, odds are you were going to get pulled into this product.
Yeah, it really was something that was addictive at the time, because if you were like a hardcore fan, you had the WWF kind of presenting you with, you know, there was some good wrestling. Bret Hart and Owen Hart had their feud in 94. And Shawn Michaels was really doing well, but then there were other guys that worked hard in that time period, Hakushi and the 1-2-3 Kid. But for the most part, you know, you had a lot of over the top cartoon stuff. WWF was very gun shy at the time from the steroid scandal and the impending trial that Vince McMahon was about to have, because he didn't have that trial until later in '94, late '94, I think. And WCW, you know, they were still trying to find themselves as they built to launching Nitro in September of 95. So when you look at like that 94, 95, 96, 97, ECW really provided an alternative because it was serious logical booking as opposed to cartoon caricatures. There was pure wrestling was very much spotlighted where you had the Malenkos and the Benoits and the Guerreros. And while these guys were well known to the diehard fans and the tape traders and the newsletter readers at the time in the early days of the internet, the average fan never really got behind them because those guys were never presented as attractions. ECW presented all of them as main eventers and attractions and champions, and that kind of led the way for those two guys to go to WCW. Then you talk about, you know, international talent, Rey Mysterio, Psicosis, Juventud Guerrera, Conan, La Parca, all those guys were well known, again, to some of the hardcore fans and obviously the fans who followed Lucha, but they were never presented as an attraction by an American product. Violence, I mean, barbed wire bats and tables and chairs and ladders and all that stuff is kind of treated like a comedy bit today when WWE and TNA do it. But in ECW, when that stuff happened, it happened because there was a reason behind it. Two guys were pissed at each other, and then they took it to the next level. Or Sabu was crazy, so he was just out of his mind and would grab the ringside table and bring it in the ring. You know, it wasn't like, oh, look, it's that point in the match. Let's go under the ring and pull some weapons out and hit each other with it. There was a reason and a logic to it. And throughout all that, the nucleus of it was great wrestling and great promos. You know, Shane Douglas, the best era of his career was that 94 to 96 or 97 era with ECW. And then you had a lot of guys underneath who were good workers and good wrestlers that were treated as just given the chance to wrestle, like Mikey Whipwreck, like Taz, who ended up becoming a star there, like J.T. Smith, who unfortunately never got out of that era and became a star somewhere else. And they were unique characters that were kind of groundbreaking. I mean, Sandman, you know, being the guy who was kind of pimping out his wife, and then he was smoking the cigarette, and then eventually he was drinking the beer. And I mean, everyone kind of knows that, you know, the cane swinging hardcore Sandman now and that character, but it built over time. It wasn't like in 2 weeks he was doing it. You know, he was doing the Sandman character for well over a year before he cracked open a beer. Why did he crack open a beer? He was having a no rope barbed wire match against Mick Foley, and after being in the ring for a minute, he needed liquid courage. And that's where the beer drinking, you know, like there was a progression to the characters. And beyond that, they treated the guy, you know, they treated everything seriously. And when kayfabe was broken, which happened there on television before anywhere else, really, it happened because there was a major injury or there was an issue and there was a reason for it. So they kind of created like this new work, you know, that we still kind of see on the internet today where guys are kind of shooting, but they're still kind of shooting, but they're really working behind their true words. And ECW is a forerunner of that, too. And, I mean, they got on pay-per-view before anybody else to the point where it meant something. It wasn't like a one-and-done. You know, now anybody, you know, the Urban Wrestling Federation is going to debut on pay-per-view in June. Like nothing. ECW had to fight and claw through all these hoops and cancellations and problems. And when they had Barely Legal on April 13th of 97, that was really the milestone of that company. That's their legacy, is that they proved that there could be a niche for an alternative wrestling product to kind of build themselves up to that fan base. And they kind of did it backwards because they did pay-per-view before they had national TV. But everyone else that followed suit, ECW kind of broke that door down, and it was a lot easier for everyone else, whether it was TNA or World Wrestling All-Stars or the UWF or any other group, you know, current or gone already, that tried to make their way to pay-per-view. Everyone else, the heroes of wrestling, groups like that, kind of had the one and done.
And one of the unique traits that, I mean, Paul Heyman and the entire environment that was kind of fostered there, specifically in the ECW arena, was that ECW was kind of always presented as this underdog promotion, never came across as an inferior product. It was simply, we are the underdogs, and kind of the fans had this investment where this is kind of like our 50-1 underdog, and suddenly when the talk of pay-per-view and television came up, it was suddenly this audience was like, finally the eyeballs are going to see what we have seen, and this 50-1 underdog might actually come through. And it was almost this kind of joint relationship between talent and spectator that created just this most unique atmosphere, I think, for ECW.
Yeah, you know, and when that pay-per-view was canceled the first time, by Request TV, because In Demand did not want to carry the pay-per-view, and Request TV were the only ones that were going to carry it, and then it was canceled. It was those fans that really took up the battle, you know, with the group that was known as Strictly ECW at the time, really, getting on, getting the word out online and going to shows and trying to get people to email and call and kind of really push for the product and kick the door down for ECW. In a lot of ways, there were fans out there who never got paid for that company who were more influential to getting that show on pay-per-view than some of the wrestlers. And I'm not saying that as disrespect to the guys, but, you know, ECW was able to kind of grab onto a really passionate niche fan base. And those fans lived and died by their ECW. I say it on the site all the time. When ECW disappeared, and you can go back and I wrote this when it died, for a lot of fans, it was like one day the New York Yankees just up and disappeared. Now, it was not a franchise that made that type of money that the New York Yankees would, but those fans lived and died by ECW. That was their home team in a lot of ways. The same way the New York Yankees, the Boston Red Sox, or any team has in a major city. Those fans lived and died by ECW. I have friends who have not watched pro wrestling from the day ECW went bankrupt. They just have no interest. And they know what I do for a living. When I bring it up, there's no interest whatsoever, just because that was their company. And, you know, ECW is kind of like Star Trek. What other wrestling group had the fans kind of demand it be brought back years after it died? You know, WWE was never going to bring that back. But all of a sudden, when they got the sales in for the rise and fall of ECW, that DVD, they kind of had no choice because they realized they were onto something. And then, you know, they made the mistake of not letting it be ECW for a new generation of fans, and we saw what happened.
And it seems that it was almost this mindset of the WWE to almost simplify this company, that it was simply a couple thousand fans that were extremely vocal, and it was a bunch of guys that did hardcore matches that didn't understand psychology. And it was just such a fundamental misunderstanding of what came out of that promotion. And I think you conveyed it very well, that it was this buffet of talent where you got to see guys like the Juventud Guerreros and Rey Mysterios first make their inroads here on a somewhat semi-national basis at the time, and get guys like Benoit and Malenko out there. And I think it was just, that to me was what was so frustrating at that 2006 period, was that here you are, you have this diehard fan base, and you're whittling away at such a loyal audience that clearly was demanding this product and almost being slapped in the face for their loyalty.
And to me, the one thing that showed that WWE was failing at this immediately, and they never bid on this, I don't know why, that first pay-per-view when they did the reunion, they charged $400 for ringside seats. The show sold out immediately.
Wow.
The next year, they came back, and I think the tickets were $200 or $250. They didn't for ringside, and then they went down. It took them weeks, but they finally sold out the building. So the ticket prices went down, and they didn't have the same demand. Now, when they came back to the Hammerstein Ballroom that last time, and it was a Sci-Fi taping, and Batista and Big Show,
right,
and fans
right.
in the building are chanting, "Change the channel," they didn't sell that building out. And the tickets were, like, I think, $75 for ringside.
Wow.
So right there, you know, one of the things that they used to like to say backstage in that company was, oh, they only had 2,500 fans, which was ridiculous because ECW ran everywhere from California to Texas to Toronto, you know that.
Yeah, right
York,
here in Mississauga.
Philly and all, Florida. So I guess 2,500 fans, all caravans, had followed this company around internationally. But that was one of the things that was said. Well, if that was the case, then why weren't these 2,500 fans showing up for the Hammerstein shows?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't because of ECW. It wasn't because of the brand name. It was because they didn't like it being presented the way that it was presented. And I mean, you know, when you look back at Barely Legal, that company kind of presented itself as something different and unique. You had crazy tag match with all these crazy spots with the Eliminators and the Dudley Boys. You had Terry Funk and Sandman and Stevie Richards do this incredible match with ladders and barbed wire and crazy spots, and the underlying story of Terry Funk trying to fight his way for one more title win because he wanted to win it at 53 years old and dedicate it to his late father, Dory Funk Sr. And yet, Raven and Tommy Dreamer, and the undertones there of Tommy was not going to let Raven destroy Tommy's mentor, and Raven wanted to demoralize Tommy by taking out Terry Funk, and he wanted to destroy Terry Funk's run for the title because Terry reminded him of his own father. And then you had the Michinoku Pro guys in from Japan, which just incredible. You know, during a time period where WCW had all the cruiserweights and WWF was trying to figure out their way and do something more with a lighter weight division, you know, the Michinoku guys walk in and really almost stole the show from the ECW guys. If Terry Funk wasn't on that show, the Michinoku Pro guys would have had the best match on that entire night. And that was just, you know, due to Sasuke and Taka Michinoku and Dick Togo and Terry Boy and all those guys just wanting to showcase themselves in the United States. And then, you know, you go underneath. I mean, when you look at that card, the only real flop on that card was Shane Douglas and Pitbull 2.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it never worked. It sucked. It was 20 minutes of wasted time, which was a shame because all, up until that match, they had had nothing but great matches. You know, and then Sabu and Taz, the only other real disappointment you could say about that is ECW did such a good job hyping that match, it didn't live up to the hype, you know, which is, but it wasn't a bad match. You go back and you watch it years later, it's not a bad match, it's a decent match. Was it the best match they ever had? Probably not, but those guys never had more pressure in their career. Yeah. I guarantee you, I bet you the day Taz debuted in the WWF in Madison Square Garden, his hometown, he wasn't as nervous as he was for that pay-per-view. Because for these guys, ECW really was their bread and butter, their life. It wasn't a job for a lot of these guys. It really was that they wanted to be ECW guys. They wanted to make a living being ECW guys. They were the fraternity to that company for both the fans and the performers. That was unlike anything I've ever seen. No one ever. It used to be back in the day, you walked around New York in 1995 and you were wearing an ECW t-shirt. If somebody knew what ECW was, you kind of had that look at each other. You kind of nodded and you had a friend right there. Because you guys were both clued into something that the average person did not know about. There's nothing like that today in wrestling at all. Not TNA, not Ring of Honor, none of those groups. There's none of that special aura to it of something unique and different. And, you know, you mentioned, you touched upon Buffet. I always used to say it was like a buffet of styles because the same card you saw Malenko and Guerrero wrestling for 20, 30 minutes, just doing great mat wrestling, you'd see Ian Rotten and Axel Rotten doing crazy strap matches and barbed wire matches and barbed wire bats and barbed wire, and then the next match you'd see a comedy tag match, or you'd see, and the match after that you'd see guys brawling all over the building, or you'd see some silliness with the Public Enemy. They just, it was perfect for that time. They marketed it perfectly to an audience that was looking for something to grab onto, and you know what? It never made millions of dollars for anybody else other than Vince McMahon, which is, you know, kind of the irony there, is that they were raging against the machine, and the only thing they ever made money for was the machine, which is completely ridiculous and unfair when you think about it, but, you know, that's life. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing you can do about that, but, you know, that Barely Legal pay-per-view was, they broke ground in a way that no one else ever has and probably no one ever will.
Do you ever look back, Mike, and think to yourself, you know, ECW, what would have been the ideal business model for this promotion? Was it to be strictly a very, very strong regional promotion based in the Northeast? I mean, a lot of fans, they'll look at right now and just the fact that TNA has lucked into so much right now, that had that been available on that very same network however many changes ago, back in 1999, how things would have been different for ECW, who lost a fraction of the money that TNA has had and has really lucked into just having a company that's willing to absorb a lot of losses. And it's interesting kind of to compare the two and the genesis of what was the Nashville network for ECW right up until its current Spike TV.
Yeah, my theory on it has always been that ECW spent themselves out of the marketplace because they had no choice but to put guys under contract once that first pay-per-view came. The pay-per-view was like the golden carrot. It was there to keep guys around. Because if that pay-per-view did not happen, these guys were going. Because they didn't have something to fight for and something to believe in. And they all believed in Paul. Whether you believe Paul fed the Melania garbage or not. And, you know, that's definitely within Paul's character. These guys needed something to believe in. They believed in Paul. And they wanted to build something up. And there was this almost like this badge of honor to the fact that, you know, we're building this. And you don't feel that in TNA or a lot of these other companies. A lot of these other companies, you know, there are guys who work hard to build it, but there's none of that, like, that just that, I'm an ECW guy. They don't have that strong branding the way the ECW guys did. And, you know, when you compare ECW and TNA, the marketplaces were completely different. But with ECW, I honestly feel that they were forced to grow. If they hadn't grown, they'd probably still be in business. You know, but Ric Flair says that about Jim Crockett Promotions. Had they stayed, you know, to the east of the Mississippi River, Flair said once, Jim Crockett would still be in business because WWF could not touch them when it came there. But once Crockett expanded too far, then the money started to stretch, and that was the beginning of the end. It was kind of the same thing with ECW because there was that huge hiring spree with WCW. They wanted guys to go up against WWF with the Monday Night War. So even if they had great talent like Malenko, Guerrero, Benoit, etc., and they were going to use them as top guys, they could still present great wrestling underneath and make their product seem fresher and hipper to the WWF, and those guys had to come from somewhere. And we saw that with ECW. There was always that rotating door of guys who were in and out, and they might have been showcased better in ECW, but they would have made more money elsewhere. So sooner or later, you have to go. You have to do what's best for your family. Too Cold Scorpio, great example of that. He never looked better than when he did in his ECW run in 95 to 97. I think 97. November 97 he left. And November 96, excuse me. He left November 96. But, so that's part one of what hurt ECW. And they've got to sign guys to contract, and now they've got to pay to upgrade the TV when they get on TNN. And they're not being paid a rights fee. If someone was going to pay ECW to have television, like TNA has or WWE has now, ECW never would have died. Because basically they mortgaged waiting for the big, the big kind of gold carrot at the end of the company. And then there was no gold carrot. And, in a lot of ways, the television industry changed and kind of looked at wrestling and went, oh, it's not that hot anymore. TBS and TNA canceled their programming. WWF went over to TNN. And USA kind of said, well, we just lost the number one wrestling guys. Why should we hire the number three company? Had USA wanted to take them, the history of the business might be different. But, it came to a point where they hit a wall. There was no more money in the coffers. ECW was too far and deep for themselves. They had too many guys signed to contracts. Some of them were probably getting paid more than they were worth because they had to hold on to them somehow. And that was it. It all came down to mathematics. You can't pay people if you're not making money. But I was at those shows all the way to the end. The shows were full. You know, it wasn't like nobody cared about ECW. It wasn't like fans didn't care. I still say to this day that there were more fans upset about ECW going out than there were WCW. And I know how silly that sounds when you think about the scope of the two companies. But by the end of WCW, people were just kind of shrugging at it and shaking their heads. ECW might not have had the name value at the end, but the wrestling was still there. Great wrestling, and that's what ECW kind of hung their hat on.
And you go back to that date, Mike, of April 13th, 1997. Tell us a bit about just the atmosphere in the crowd that day, of what that meant to the audience getting onto pay-per-view, and your initial reactions once that show came to its conclusion that night.
Oh, my God. There were so many things. The gods were on ECW's side that night. Because, first of all, that building is in the... I don't know if you've ever been there, John. But
I haven't been there, unfortunately.
That building is in the worst area ever. And I often joke to my friends that you've been here too often when you think the neighborhood's not that bad anymore. It's worse now than it was then. And, it literally is this warehouse that looks like a toaster on the outside. It's this dirty, disgusting little building. And when you walked in, it was like, oh my God, they painted the place. There were white walls and there were new guardrails and they had a lighting truss up there, which was ridiculous when you think about the small size of this building. And in typical ECW fashion, the fans were just there all day. Even if they had ringside tickets, they were hanging out all day. Everyone was all excited and tailgating, and this was like the night. This was the coming out party for ECW. And I'll never forget, they had like one or two dark matches. Joey Styles gets in the ring to kind of hype up the crowd before they go live on pay-per-view. He gets in the ring, the mic is dead. The mic is not alive.
Oh, wow.
And now it's like 8:58, the show's going on at 9 o'clock. That was the only thing. They had to go on at 9 o'clock because they were too adult for a regular pay-per-view time.
That's right.
Which was like, crazy when you think about it. But 9 o'clock on a Sunday they had. So Joey is like trying desperately. They're trying to fix the mic. And the fans are realizing, like, the show's going on the air in like a minute. And everybody just starts chanting ECW. Just the whole building is chanting ECW just because when they go on the air, they got to do something. And nobody prodded them. Nobody asked the fans to do this. No one's out there, come on, do something for us. Like you see at TNA with SoCal Valor, Jeremy Borash, and people kind of prodding the fans in Universal. It was none of that. It was just fans cared that much that they were all chanting it. And then, like, in true ECW fashion, 2 seconds before they go on the air, Joey's hitting the mic and you hear thump, 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 thump over the loud mic. And Joey takes the mic and goes, hello, everyone, and welcome, da da da. And the place just went nuts.
Wow.
Because it was true ECW fashion, just yanked their asses out of the fire at the last second. And now, in a lot of ways, that was just the story of the company. They went all the way to the end and somehow they saved their own asses until finally they couldn't save them anymore. And the show itself was great. I remember sitting there as a fan in the front row and just being so happy for everybody because you'd seen these guys break themselves down and destroy themselves and bleed and work hard. And you'd, as a fan, you really rode that roller coaster of every high and every low with the company, which was completely different from any other companies before or since. You know, it might have sucked that, hey, Steve Austin broke his neck in the WWF, but unless you were like the diehard Steve Austin fan, you weren't like, oh my God, how are they going to get out of this? And that's kind of how it was with ECW when everything went wrong. It was like, as a fan, you sat there and thought, oh my God, how are they going to pull this off? You know, Malenko, Graham, Benoit get hired the same day. How is this company going to survive? These are all the guys you kind of hung your hat on for the wrestling aspect. And then you waited to see what would happen, and they brought in Ray and Psychosis in the next month. Everything was okay, you know? And the fire incident, nah, it's got to be the end of the company. They're doomed. It's over. And then the next month, they kind of, you know, Paul comes out there and gives a public apology and brings back Sabu, who he had fired 6 months before, to make good to the fans. You know, there were a million stories like that with ECW. And the day it went off the air, that pay-per-view, it literally was, they got to the end of the pay-per-view, Terry Funk pins Raven, and Terry had done this promo thing. He wanted the fans to chant our way because they had gotten to pay-per-view the ECW way, not anybody else's way. And this was like on the go-home show for the TV show. And literally, Terry wins the title. He and Tommy Dreamer get in the crowd. Some fans start chanting our way. The other fans all pick up on it. Our way, our way, our way. They go off the air. 2 seconds after they go off the air, 2 seconds, literally, the transformer that they brought in to run the satellite blows up.
Wow.
Goes out. There's no power in the building other than the building's own lighting. They don't even have a mic. And the place is just going nuts. It was like the World Series and the Super Bowl all at once. I've never seen so many fans jumping up and down, embracing each other. Joey Styles was like on the balcony above the front door of the building, which they call the Eagle's Nest. And he's jumping up and down, tears in his eyes, and he comes down and runs through the crowd to go up to see his wife. And Paul Heyman and Todd Gordon are hugging on the stage. And then Paul, you know, after like everyone's chanting for a speech, and Paul's like, 5 minutes, give me 5 minutes with his hand. And he goes in the back and he addresses the guys. And then Paul comes out and he gives his whole speech, and there's no mic. No mic. So you talk about the vile, hardcore, crazy wrestling audience. Everyone's standing there out of respect and silence, listening. Paul thank everyone. And Paul saying, I don't know how I'm ever going to thank all of you, and thank you so much for supporting us and always giving us a second chance. And in typical Philadelphia fashion, the fans start chanting free show next month. And then, you know, it was like Paul's like, oh, you guys. And, you know, all the baby faces came out and kind of like, you know, were high-fiving each other and hugging in the ring. And it was a special night. And I've been to WrestleManias. I've been to SummerSlam. I've been to Legends conventions. I've been to every wrestling company you can think of. I have been there for Ric Flair's retirement. I have been there for Shawn Michaels' retirement. I have been there for many, many pay-per-views, television tapings, left and right. I have never seen anything as a fan more special or unique than that night. And when you look at it from a wrestling standpoint, was it the best pay-per-view? Probably not. The production is nowhere near as good as it could have been. But for guys who never did live television before, never produced a live television show before, going on pay-per-view for the first time with a bunch of guys, most of whom had never been on television other than a couple of WWF appearances, this is a pretty damn special show. And from an emotional standpoint, with that Terry Funk stuff and just the uniqueness of that audience and that crowd, nothing's ever going to touch that. I'll go to WrestleMania as long as I have to, and hopefully I'll do this for the rest of my life. I'll never see something as unique or as special as I did that night in that building. And, you know, that place really was an incredible place, because when you trace back so many lives and careers, a lot of them all started in ECW. There's a whole generation of guys who are wrestling now who got involved and wanted to go to the business because they went to ECW, or they loved what ECW has to do. You know, I've had conversations with Eddie Kingston, who's talked about that. You know, he wanted to be an ECW guy. And Quiet Storm, who went on to work a lot in Michinoku Pro in Japan, I remember seeing him with his mother sitting in the crowd of the ECW, the Elks Lodge in New York City years ago when he was a teenager. And there's a million guys like that. And not only that, you know, I wouldn't be writing if it wasn't for ECW. Because it put me off in the right position, in the right direction of my life at the right moment. And a lot of other people, you look at how the business has changed with hardcore matches and TLC matches and guys who got a chance to work for WCW and the WWF and make 6 and 7 figures and be world champions. They might not have never gotten that chance if ECW hadn't given them a spot. You know, you think anybody would ever hire Dean Malenko? I love Malenko. Nobody ever. He was around for years. No one ever tried to hire him until he was in ECW and he was showcased as an asset. You know, Eddie Guerrero, Benoit, those guys might have made it because they were so awesome. But they might have made it in Japan before they came over here. You know, ECW really changed just the timeline of wrestling and kind of skewed things, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worst. But without that time period, the whole wrestling business would be different.
Well, one of the things I also want to ask you about, Mike, is that when Beyond the Mat came out a couple of years later in 2000, I'm curious, what was your reaction watching that documentary and seeing how Barely Legal came across in there? Because all of a sudden, like, I obviously you wouldn't have seen the Paul Heyman speech before the pay-per-view at that time, but suddenly, I mean, that must have just added things even more to a historical perspective of just how it was presented in that documentary.
I actually saw that. I was actually one of the first people to see the finished film. Barry Blaustein brought it to Chicago and showed it to a bunch of writers the weekend of ECW's Anarchy Rules pay-per-view, which was the first pay-per-view after they got a national TV. So I saw it in the room with like maybe 15 or 20 people, and I remember thinking, wow, everybody looks so young. Because I think seeing that film was the first time I realized how hard the wrestling business ages guys
sure.
to work in it. And when I saw footage from 97, the same weekend I was seeing guys in 99, I thought, wow, Pitbulls and Mikey Whipwreck and these guys, they look so much older 2 years later. And I remember thinking, like, they did a really good job of presenting ECW as, like, these underdog, like, you know, mom-and-pop operation type of deal. And the only and I felt they kind of did ECW justice, but for a film that wasn't about ECW. But, they, you know, the interesting thing was they kind of played it off like that was Paul's house where they were filming the TV. And it wasn't. It was like the parents of Ron Buffone, the TV producer.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of like, I guess because they never made it clear, people thought that was like Paul's house and Paul's basement. And it really wasn't. But that the way they presented ECW is kind of how it was. I remember they kind of called it like the Ellis Island of wrestling, where like old wrestlers went to be rediscovered and new guys went to become stars. And that's kind of what ECW was, and there's nothing like that today. And I think the other thing, they kind of called it like almost like a commune where everybody pitched in, and that's kind of a fair assessment as well. It, you know, people talk about the cult and drinking the Kool-Aid and all that stuff, and nobody was there for any other reason other than they wanted to be there, because there was something cool and unique about ECW that stood out at the time period. And you look back now and you go, well, it kind of sucks these guys took so many hard shots to the head, and but we didn't, you know, there wasn't the education then that we have now. There wasn't a Chris Nowinski to kind of shed the light on it and go, this, you know, this is a lot more serious than people realize. And, you know, and the other thing I always find interesting is people always talk about it was a blood and guts promotion. ECW was the only company that banned the blade for a time period when Tommy Morrison was diagnosed with HIV when he was the boxer. They did away with blood for months on end. So it wasn't even like a blood and guts promotion. You know, they certainly hung their hat on it, and they certainly marketed that themselves that way. But they were just the culmination of everything at once. And it'll never be recreated. It never can be recreated. Even if someone handed Paul Heyman $10 billion, he couldn't recreate ECW the way that it was originally presented. Because the entire television industry has changed, you know. There's no going out there and syndicating a TV show to a bunch of stations at 2-3 o'clock in the morning and hoping people will latch onto it and come to your shows. And honestly, the production values, you couldn't get away with a TV show with those production values these days, because, you know, the bar has been raised so high by WWE and even TNA, because TNA's TV show, as much as we all want to pull our hair out over it, it looks like $1 million, and that's why they make so much money on international syndication, because it looks great.
Yep.
ECW never could have pulled that off.
And as we finish off here, Mike, I mean, when you look back at the run of this promotion, I mean, can you look at Barely Legal as kind of the peak point of ECW, or was it some different time period for you? I mean, where do you look at where ECW kind of knew what its position was within the wrestling landscape and was achieving things at its highest point?
I think 1995 mm-hmm. was their peak year for wrestling and an overall product. But I mean, you had Benoit, Malenko, Guerrero, Public Enemy, Sabu, Taz, Ray, Psychosis, Mick Foley, who, you know, his role in ECW is very understated. Just incredible promos at the time. He did a lot to bring out the legitimacy of a lot of guys, including Dreamer and Raven. You had Raven, you had Terry Funk. I mean, that was an amazing year. 1995 was an incredible year for that company, and I'll put that 1 year of television up against anybody and say that, you know, it'll stand the test of time. In terms of their long-term legacy, I always look at Barely Legal as the day that they finally succeeded despite themselves and despite outside influences, but also that was like the day that the clock started ticking on the death certificate of the company. Because
yeah.
Now that they were on the map, immediately Raven was signed away by WCW. Immediately they had a slew of injuries with Stevie Richards and Perry Saturn. Perry Saturn was signed away by WCW. You know, Stevie Richards left, and he never returned to ECW in a way that kind of meant anything. And that was kind of the beginning, you know, that was the beginning of the end, where guys were now moving on to the next level of their careers, and the Dudleys were leaving eventually, and Taz was leaving eventually. Sabu had his blowout with Paul Heyman, eventually left. New Jack had problems and eventually left. You know, so now that they had kind of staked their place, outside influences and personal issues and egos and injuries started to chip away at ECW. So to me, that was, if you had to draw a graph, Barely Legal was the top of that graph, and then everything else, little by little, they started sliding downward again. And, you know, they fought the good fight until finally there was nothing left.
Well, it was just such a fun show to go back and watch, and I've watched it, I mean, numerous times, and I think nothing can compare to the live experience. Like, I had to watch this on the Pioneer video that came out years later, as amazing as that was to believe, with, I mean, tons of edits to it, and you got, you know.
I worked on that DVD, and I begged them not to edit anything.
Really?
They wouldn't listen. If you go back, I worked on that, and I wrote all the profiles for the matches on that DVD. I worked on that entire DVD line, and I could tell you stories, ridiculous stories, about trying to explain to them why certain things shouldn't be edited off the DVDs, and it was just, a lot of times it was music rights, because the music and the audio were on the same audio
right.
track, audio level, and they couldn't separate the music, so they had to remove it, because there was no other way to do it. Other than completely whitewashing out all the music, muting it out, and having new voiceovers put over it, and they weren't going to spend the money to do that. So it's not like WWE where they kind of had the technology. Pioneer was very much doing that on a shoestring budget and trying to get the most out of the least. But yeah, I remember looking at that DVD and being upset about a lot of the edits on that one when I saw it. That was not one I was happy with.
So how was it decided to go from the like the Sandman with Metallica over to Motorhead, which was on the home video? How was that?
Because ECW had the rights for the Motorhead version.
Oh, I see.
Because of the ECW album that was on the Motorhead version was on the ECW record.
I see.
And so they just went to the Concrete Music, who had licensed all the music, and said, "Can we use this?" And because it was an ECW thing, there was kind of, you know, they had the corporate synergy. Because on that, and I think the one song that they were able to license, because Dr. Dre was willing to work with them, was the Natural Born Killers, the Gangsta song, which is on a bunch of the ECW Pioneer DVDs.
Right.
But with a lot of other guys, it was, we have to change the music because we can't pay the rights, or ECW had the rights for certain aspects, but not for DVD, because DVD was also a very developing medium at that point. You know, had DVD and YouTube and things like that been stronger earlier on, ECW might have been able to weather the storm. Who knows? I mean, they were selling VHS tapes of everything until the last year.
Mm-hmm.
DVD really didn't come around until, I think, 99 or 2000.
Yeah.
And by January 2001, for all intents and purposes, ECW was dead. So, that was very early on in the DVD medium, too. In fact, I think Beyond the Mat might have been the first DVD I ever bought. Now that I think about it.
Yeah,
so,
it would have been right around that time period. It might have been the same one for me. How did the Pioneer video sales overall, was it something, were sales very strong for them? Because myself, we didn't get it at all here in Canada, and it was actually, I just happened by chance, I was on vacation in Florida, found this in a store, and just boom, here's my money. Got Barely Legal here. It was a show that was, you know, up here in Canada, unfortunately, it was very hard to find anything ECW-related before the TNN deal.
Yeah, they always did well because they always kept coming back and doing more. So, I mean, I was never told strong sales numbers, but it was always, hey, we're gonna do two more. Like, they always did everything in either multiples of two or four. And then, in fact, I even got paid to write two more scripts that never got produced because the ECW bankruptcy kind of got settled. Like, they were still using stuff even after the company was bankrupt, because they were just trying to churn out content to make whatever money they could off the license, because they knew in the end they were going to lose it to WWE. I wrote a Best of Van Damme and a Best of Taz script, And I believe they started producing those, but they never got released. Like, I know the editing process was going on, but nothing ever happened with those. I was always told the Barely Legal DVD and the Best of McFoley, which I wrote, were kind of the ones that were the strongest sellers. But some of those are good, man. There's a lot. My favorite was always the Hardcore History one. I thought they did a great job on that. And there was another title, I think it was Deep Impact. Those were the two that I thought they had a nice mix of wrestling and craziness. But yeah, I loved working on that DVD line. That was some of my favorite stuff. And it was funny because I remember they came to me, and I've told this story before. They wanted to do a Best of Kid Cash and a Best of During and Roadkill DVD. And I was like, why?
Yeah.
And they were like, well, they were the champions at the end. And I was like, guys, I love those guys, but they're not going to sell.
Yeah.
And I kind of had to go back and pitch them on a Best of McFoley, like, within an hour. And I, like, had literally written, like, the first outline for the DVD within an hour. And they were like, all right, well, we'll do that then. Because my thought was, you know, you have, like, 2 years of McFoley footage, and now he's in WWF on top as Mankind. And you've got all this great stuff. And I think, you know, with all due respect to Kid Cash and Danny Doering, I don't think the average wrestling fan out in Kansas is going to be willing to buy that DVD. And, you know, my job there was to try and come up with ways to keep making that line money.
And just with Mick Foley, I mean, the promos alone, I mean, you could have almost put together a DVD. That was always something I wanted to see, was just some of those late night sessions and just throw out the raw promos that they would do, you know, late at the arena till like 4 or 5 in the morning.
Every now, you know, what Mick Foley DVD, one of those had like some unedited footage, but for the most part, like a lot of that stuff never got saved, I don't think.
Yeah.
Because I think ECW literally was just taping over tapes at one point because they needed footage. I remember pitching so hard, I really wanted to do a Raven Dreamer feud set.
Oh, yeah.
And just do, like, the beginning of the feud to the day Raven left, and kind of do it in the vein that I did the ECW, the Raven, not the Raven, the Mick Foley DVD, because I thought you could kind of edit the stuff that wasn't strong or didn't live up to history, and have Joey or whoever kind of talking it over and showing clips. And then the stuff that was strong, you could show that in its entirety, which was my idea behind the Mick Foley DVD. You know, edit the stuff that doesn't stand out, the stuff that still stood out greater, historically was very important, show all of it, and you can kind of tell the whole story in a couple hours. And they never bid on it. And I'll always be very disappointed by that, because to me, Raven and Dreamer was one of those great feuds where they started out on the lower card of the show, and then over time, they made their way up to the main event. And by the time Raven left, those guys were bona fide main eventers, and Dreamer went from being this guy fans kind of like scoffed at, wearing the suspenders, to being the guy they were all chanting he's hardcore, and bought him as the innovator of violence. And that was, you know, that really was a credit to Raven, who kind of brought him up, and also guys like Foley and Funk, and even a credit to Dreamer, who worked himself up in front of a really unforgiving crowd as someone who they kind of scoffed at him and rolled their eyes, and now he was like, you know, Superman there.
Well, Mike, this has just been a great time chatting with you. I could probably chat with you just for hours about various topics. But as we wrap up here, just for listeners checking in right now, I'm sure familiar with PWInsider.com, but just tell our listeners a bit about the site and some projects that might be upcoming to check out.
Well, yeah, PWInsider.com. You know, we've got two versions of the site. We've got our regular version, which anybody can read, and then we've got our ad-free elite version, which is on a separate server at PWInsiderElite.com, and that's got daily audio updates and a lot of interviews. And we actually did like a 90-minute look back on the ECW Barely Legal weekend when the anniversary of the show came up last week. And, you know, we do like 2 or 3 audios every day after every major TV show, after every pay-per-view. There's always like 3 to 5 interviews a week. And we've had everyone from Terry Funk to different indie guys. Like a couple weeks ago, we had a lot of Chikara guys because of the King of Trios. And, you know, we try to focus on a lot of the major independent shows, plus WWE and TNA and Ring of Honor. And, you know, I always kind of like go like look at it and go, as a wrestling fan, what would I want to see and what would I want to read about? And that's kind of what I focus on. And, you know, we've kind of carved a very lucky niche for ourselves, and a very unique niche. And you know, we have a lot of silliness on the site, as well as a lot of serious hard news, and we've got a lot of very interesting personalities doing audio. So you can check us out 3 days free, and if you don't like it, you can tell us to bug off and never look at us again. So if you get a chance, check it out. And if not, you know, follow us on Twitter or, you know, twitter.com/PWInsiderCom, or, you know, read the free site and check us out. And, you know, hopefully you like what you see.
Well, I guarantee anyone that checks it out will be hooked, much like myself. You, Buck, Dave, you guys all do a fantastic job, your whole team over there. And, Mike, thanks so much for spending some time with us and kind of going down memory lane here with us. It was a lot of fun chatting with you about this.
Anytime you want to do it, I'll be more than happy to make time for you, John. You're a good guy. You work hard, and I know you guys up there do a great job, too. So we appreciate you as well.
So a big thank you to Mike Johnson for joining us. You can catch all of his work at pwinsider.com, a great resource for wrestling news out there and some great audio shows that they do as well. So, Wade, that's going to wrap things up for this week, a packed edition, and you have another comment to make.
Well, I just wanted to say, if you enjoyed this review or any of our reviews or any of the Laws reviews or Laws shows, please come out to the Toronto area this Thursday night to Tryst Nightclub.
Yes, a nightclub that it's amazing that me and Wei Ting have never been to before. If you'd like to hang out with us, we're going to be at King and Peter this coming Thursday night.
Sean Shirk will be there.
Spencer Fisher and Brendan Schaub.
Yes, this is, of course, in promotion of the UFC coming up and also in promotion of the newly rebranded Fight Network.
Get the out.
Yes, Fight Network. We're going to be at Tryst, which is at 82 Peter Street, and there's going to be a party with fighters,
MMA hotties.
Expo hotties.
That's what they're called. The Expo hotties are going to be there.
Plus, myself, John Pollock, and perhaps even an appearance from Dan the Mouth Oransky and Jason Agnew.
Yeah, so we're all going to be there. The Fight Network crew is going to be there, and of course, three UFC fighters and the Expo hotties. So, hey, if you have nothing to do next Thursday night and you want to come down to Tryst Nightclub, by all means, come up, and we have no problem if you simply want to chat wrestling with us.
Oh, yeah.
I'd be more than happy to have a beer and talk about wrestling because that's what people do at Tryst Nightclub.
Totally. Yes. So
that's coming up this Thursday, everybody, if you're in the Toronto area or want to make the trek. All right. How much are tickets, Wei?
Tickets are, for general admission, $20 in advance, $25 at the door before 11 o'clock, and doors open at 10 o'clock. I feel like such a whore.
We were not asked to promote this. We're doing this on our own accord.
Yeah, we are.
Everyone.
But there are also VIP passes that are available at 9. I don't like doing this. I feel so uncomfortable doing this. I just want to – we want to hang out with you guys. Come out if you're around and hit us up on Facebook for details. That's all. This is silly.
I also want to just whore the fact, because there's something in this for our listeners here, is that right now on pretty much most carriers in Canada, the Fight Network has a free preview right now.
That's right. Yes.
So you can enjoy that for the rest of April. Monday night, we have two new editions of Ultimate Classic Wrestling at 8 and 11 Eastern, and specifically, everyone, the 8 o'clock airing. Wei, you shot this. The first matchup, right off the top of the hour, we have Tony Atlas teaming with Ivan Putski. And yes, Scott Putski.
Whoa.
So if everyone would like to tune in, there's some interesting...
For free, you can see.
You can check this out. We're not asking you for any money here.
Very rare Scott Putski match.
Yeah, and there's a match with that Sushi Onita on that show. And then 11 o'clock, we've got a show that's headlined by Kerry Von Erich and the Great Kabuki against Chris Adams and Gino Hernandez from World Class Championship Wrestling. Mm-hmm. Some of these tapes we get, there's some incredible stuff on these shows.
There really is, and it's really a wonder why the WWE has not acquired this stuff yet.
Some of it, yes.
Maybe I should close my mouth. But yes, Steve Austin even makes an appearance.
Yeah, this is on the 11 o'clock show. It's one of Steve Austin's first matches where he's competing as Steve Williams at the time, taking on Chris Youngblood. So anyway, that's some extra stuff if you don't have enough wrestling in your diet, everybody. And of course, we will be back on Tuesday with Review of Raw and reviewing Tough Enough. This is going to be a crazy week for us with all this UFC stuff, but we will... have our shows coming out this week. Wei, let's finish off here. What would you like to review next week?
Well, since I will be so sick of the UFC already, why not review more of it? Because we've reviewed UFC 2 in the past, and, you know, not the most responsive.
Let's see. I was very impressed with the turnout on the Super J Cup last week. So, guys, keep an open mind, okay? Let's just... We're by no means transitioning over to an all MMA review show. We're just trying one here because it's timely here in Toronto.
And then we got to say the UFC now is nothing like what it was back at the very, very beginning of UFC 1. It was really a bit of a clusterfuck in many ways. So, very entertaining review, I'm sure.
So what do you want to review?
UFC 1.
Okay, okay. It was UFC 2 we reviewed before.
Yeah, that's
okay.
I said all this. Were you not paying attention?
No, I wasn't. I was thinking ahead to what song to pick. All right, so UFC 1, the beginning, we will review from November of 93.
Wow. Yeah. What day was it?
It was a Saturday. Yeah.
Okay.
It's interesting because in that time period, within like 4 months, we had the debut of Michinoku Pro, the debut of Pancrase, and we had shortly thereafter with UFC, we had the transition from Eastern Championship Wrestling to Extreme Championship Wrestling. So there was a ton going on at that time period that would shape the rest of the 90s and into this decade too. So I'm going to go with our song to go out. You know, we've had the great Sasuke featured last week and this week. So when I saw him doing karaoke online this week of It's My Life by John Bon Jovi,
I thought,
what better person to close out Review Away than the great Sasuke singing It's My Life.
I ain't gonna live forever. I just wanna live.
Right now!
I ain't gonna live forever.